Shadow Flight by Joe Weber, being performed by Tech Murdoch.
Levchenko followed the takeoff and initial climb. He lowered the binoculars, zipped his jacket, and got back inside the warm, idling automobile. The KGB stealth project officer was feeling more and more confident by the minute. After waiting 8 months and enduring many arduous trips to Moscow, Levchenko had received permission straight from Golodnikov, chief of the KGB, to commandeer a stealth bomber. He had a meeting in San Bernardino with Irina Rykov, the KGB agent who was responsible for initiating the B-2 hijacking. Now, Levchenko thought, Rykov can execute the final step to carry the hijacking to completion. The motherland would have an American B-2 stealth bomber in a matter of weeks. The Northrop B-2 banked gently to the left, then returned to level flight as U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Charles E. Matthews scanned the clouds below his invisible bomber. "Shadow 3-7 Mystic," drawled a deep voice. "7-3, replied the stealth's co-pilot, Major Paul Evans. "Ghost 2-5 is closing from your 8 o'clock, 3 miles, responded the airborne controller. Evans keyed his radio mic. "We got a radar lock. Should be a visual shortly." "Concur, 3-7, the airborne warning and control officer replied. "Ghost 2-5 will be up your frequency in 15 seconds. Chuck Matthews glanced at his co-pilot, then back to the civilian tech rep occupying the cramped third seat. Shadow 37, the 6th B-2 off the Northrop assembly line, was undergoing a series of technical evaluations before final acceptance by the Strategic Air Command. "Ready, Larry?" "All set, Colonel. Avionics, automation up," Lawrence Simmons answered nervously, trying to quell his anxiety. He could feel his pulse racing as he contemplated executing his mission. He hoped that the other two crew members had not noticed his shaking hands. "Ghost 2-5, Matthews paused, glancing over his left shoulder through the cockpit side window. "We have a radar lock at our 8 o'clock, 2.5 miles. The radio scrambler hummed as a new voice, crisp and articulate, sounded in the helmets of the stealth crew. "That's us, Shadow. Are you on top?" "That's a firm, Ghost 2-5, Matthews answered. Both Air Force aircraft would be operating as a team during the joint United States-Canadian Forces Operation Vail. The purpose of the operation was to evaluate each bomber's ability to penetrate random radar defenses, survive the simulated bombing raid, then safely egress from the target area. The setting sun forced the stealth's pilot to squint as he watched the B-1B emerge slowly from the puffy overcast. "Okay, Ghost," Matthews radioed, banking the B-2 into the approaching strategic bomber. "I've got a visual." "Roger, Shadow 3-7, the B-1B co-pilot replied. "We have a tally." "Colonel," Evans said over the aircraft intercom system, "we're 15 miles from the initial point and we have computer alignment." "Okay," Matthews replied. "Let's go heads up. Nav lights out." The well-built, sandy-haired pilot looked at Evans. "Checklist." The co-pilot placed the three-position master mode switch in the go-to-war setting. The flight controls now operated in a stealth mode. The radio emitters were turned off and the weapons systems were readied. Larry Simmons looked nervous around the cockpit. He felt a constriction in his chest but dismissed the pain as psychosomatic. Matthews watched the B-1B as the dark camouflaged bomber settled into a loose formation to the left of the stealth. "Ghost 2-5, the controller ordered. "Turn left to 305, descend to your strike profile, and stop squawk out for flight level 310. Good hunting." "Roger, Mystic," replied the B-1B co-pilot. Neither bomber crew would communicate with anyone until the 4-hour, 15-minute mission had been completed. Only an emergency would take precedence over the sortie. The order from the controller to stop squawk provided the bomber pilots with the opportunity to disappear, literally vanish from any type of radar that might be tracking the aircraft. When the crews turned off their transponders, their radar signatures disappeared. "Now," ordered the stocky, dark-haired co-pilot, glancing over his left shoulder at Simmons, who had access to a third transponder, The normal transponder with a primary and a secondary transmitter was located on the console between the pilot's seats. A single-head backup transponder with a separate power supply had been installed for the testing and evaluation of each B-2. Number three off, Simmons answered. You okay, Larry? Evans asked, half turning his head. Yes, the technician answered, averting his eyes. Perspiration soaked his sage-green flight suit. It must have been the burritos I ate. Here we go, Matthews said as he lowered the stealth's nose and reduced power on the four General Electric engines. Shadow 37 penetrated the dense cloud cover, rocking gently in the light turbulence. The airspeed was passing 440 knots as the covert strike radar began to see enemy radar missions. Simmons squirmed in his seat, clearly ill at ease, as he adjusted the setting in his transponder. The tech rep fumbled with three circuit breakers, one for each transponder, then pulled all three and placed clips over the two marked primary and secondary. He then placed the temporary transponder switch to the on position, patted his zipped thigh pocket, and wiped his forehead with the back of his flight glove. The numeric code that Simmons had dialed into his transponder, if energized by pushing the circuit breaker back into place, would automatically trigger alarms in ground-based radar facilities, code 7700, indicated an emergency condition. General Carlton Donovan, SAC commander, listened intently as he watched the time event display tracking the expected positions of the Shadow 37 and Ghost 25. The same information was being observed in the National Military Command Post at the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. Only General Donovan, his immediate staff, and the bomber crews knew the course that would be flown to the respective targets. Canadian and U.S. teams on board two AWACS aircraft would attempt to track the elusive bombers, while ground surveillance centers focused on detecting the intruders. Donovan looked at his display board, which clearly defined the route of each bomber. Well, Walt, we'll see if your boys are on their toes this evening. The four-star general enjoyed working with the scrappy Canadian fighter pilot and longtime friend, Major General Sterling Walter Bothwell, Royal Canadian Air Force. We'll by God give her a go. May be a bit dicey, General. Both officers were positioned in the rear of the SAC control center on the elevated platform. Each had a commanding view of the continuously changing tracking graphics on the brightly lighted display board. If Shadow Flight is on time, they should be turning west over Belcher Islands. This leg should be interesting. The stealth flying wing rolled out of the steep left turn and started a descent toward the pitch-black waters of Hudson Bay. 4,000 feet to level off. Okay, Matthews replied, easing the B-2's nose up 3 degrees. I'm starting to level off. Watch our altitude. Roger. Larry Simmons watched the altimeter unwind through 3,900 feet, then removed his flying gloves and wiped his perspiring palms on his thighs. He reached over to the panel at his shoulder and pushed in the circuit breaker to the temporary transponder. He left it activated for 7 seconds. The tech rep then placed a retainer around the circuit breaker, as he had the other transponder breakers, to prevent it from being shoved in accidentally. 1,000 to go, Chuck, Evans said. Check, Matthews replied. 400 feet, we're level. Shadow 37 was now traveling over the bay at almost 8 nautical miles a minute. Matthews keyed his intercom system. How you doing, Larry? 5 seconds passed without a response from the weapons systems technician. Evans cocked his head to the left to look at Simmons. What he saw horrified him. Peter Dawson, journeyman traffic controller, stared at his radar scope. The emergency transponder squawk, 7700, was real. The code which set off the control center alarm had appeared instantaneously. Dawson's supervisor, Bruce Cochran, was already standing behind him, leaning over his shoulder. Where the blazes did that come from? Well, you got me, Dawson replied, looking confused. Get on the landline, Peter, the supervisor ordered, looking closer at the radar scope. Find out what's going on out there. Dawson nodded in response, then talked briefly with a controller in the Winnipeg sector. The young air traffic controller specialist listened to his associate, signed off, and then turned to his supervisor. I don't have a clue, Bruce, Dawson said. That squawk popped up from an area that's temporarily restricted. Some kind of military operation. How long was it on the scope? I'm not sure, Dawson responded. 4, maybe 5 seconds, long enough to trigger the alarm. Better whistle up the military boys and signal the rescue people. I think someone is shy one airplane. Major Paul Evans, frozen in terror, stared at the business end of a bright orange flare gun. The muzzle was only 4 inches from his face. Evans glanced down at the object in Simmons' lap. The technician had opened the valve of his temporary oxygen bottle. He was filling the cockpit with pure oxygen. One spark and the Shadow 37 would explode in a thundering conflagration. "What the hell are you doing?" Evans shouted as he reached over to tap Matthews on the sleeve. The aircraft commander glanced quickly over his shoulder. "God damn, Larry, why..." "Shut up, both of you," Simmons said in a shaky, strained voice. He was having a difficult time remembering the speech he had been taught. Both pilots remained silent, gave each other a fearful look. They were surprised when the AWACS radioed on the emergency guard, 243.0 frequency. The airborne controllers had also seen the emergency code flash on their radar scopes. "Ghost 2-5 and Shadow 3-7, this is Mystic," the AWACS officer said. "Acknowledge." Matthews attempted to speak to Simmons as Evans keyed his radio. "Larry, you can't get... Don't use the radio," Simmons commanded, holding the quivering flare gun next to Evans' neck. "Unplug your radio cords, both of you. Now! We're shutting down all systems and missions, everything." Matthews and Evans complied with the order. Matthews scanned the primary flight instruments, checked the engine readouts, then spoke to his co-pilot. "Paul, take the controls and stay on course." Simmons spoke to the aircraft commander. "Colonel Matthews, I am in control of the flight. I give the orders. Now turn to a course of 187 and go up to 51,000 feet. Now, I'm defecting to a communist state and taking this airplane with me. I will not hesitate to blow this airplane out of the sky if you attempt to resist." "All right, Larry," Matthews responded. "No problem. Just don't do anything irrational, okay?" Simmons nodded. He then leaned back and wiped the perspiration from his cheeks. His chest pounded as he realized that he, Lawrence Maynard Simmons, had done it. Crossed the line. He would be a hero in his new country, a man admired by his lover, Irina Rykov. Larry, two minor details. We're headed for Cleveland, not to any foreign country, and we don't have the fuel to make it to any other part of the world. Simmons unfolded a large chart and handed it to Evans. "Yes, we do," he replied, watching the surprised co-pilot glance at the map, then hand it to Matthews. General Donovan was startled when his radio speaker came to life. "Vail Control, we have an emergency. Repeat, we have an emergency." "Mystic, this is General Donovan. Explain the nature of your emergency." "We just received a confirmed 7700 squawk, sir. The IFF code came from the area we suspect the B-2 was penetrating." "Abort the mission, Mystic. Break radio silence and call both aircraft." "General, we've called both aircraft on guard. Ghost 2-5 checked in immediately. Shadow 3-7 hasn't responded, sir." "Activate air-sea rescue on the double. I want every available piece of equipment over the area where the distress signal originated." "We'll go, Vail," the controller replied. "Mother of God," Matthews said as the B-2 climbed through 7,000 feet. "Cuba?" "Yes. San Julian. I'll tell you what our real problem is going to be. Even Cuba is beyond our fuel range, including reserves." "No tricks, Colonel. I mean what I say. I'll blow us out of the air if you try to stop me." "God damn it, Larry. It won't make any difference whether you destroy us now or we wait to crash in the Gulf of Mexico. We aren't carrying a full load of fuel." Evans broke the silence as the powerful bomber climbed through 13,000 feet. "Larry, he isn't trying to trick you. Look at the figures." Simmons stared at the screen. 1,820 nautical miles to San Julian. Range to fuel exhaustion, counting the built-in reserve, indicated 1,790 nautical miles. Major Evans, I know you can step climb to 51,000 as we burn off fuel, then make an idle descent into Cuba. Evans spoke slowly. That is correct, to a certain point. But we don't know what the winds are going to be like at altitude. We don't have any current weather information, and we don't have any instrument approach plates for San Julian. Simmons struggled to extract three pieces of tightly folded paper from his left thigh pocket. This will help us guide us in, Colonel, Simmons said, handing the Cuban Revolutionary Air Force and Anti-Aircraft Defense airport diagrams to the pilot. Matthews looked at the instrument approach plates with the hand-drawn lines. I assume, Larry, that we're going to have an escort down that line to San Julian. That's correct. When we reach that point, still at our cruising altitude, we'll energize our transponder and radar so the MiGs can join up with us. Well, Larry, you've thought of everything except one item. If we don't run out of fuel, that is. Yeah, Colonel? What's the one item? That the commies are going to kill you after they get their hands on this airplane. Shadow 37 was now passing directly over Detroit, invisible to radar screens in the Cleveland Air Route Traffic Control Center. Larry, I recommend we turn on the radios so we can at least monitor traffic and get some weather information. Okay, but don't try anything. One word and I'll pull the trigger. Neither officer answered as they quickly activated the VHF and UHF radios and plugged in their radio cords. The padded earphones in each crew member's helmet immediately crackled to life. The Cleveland Center, citation 555 Tango Charlie, with you at 510. Matthews and Evans, startled, looked at each other, then listened intently to the conversation. The business jet was cruising at their altitude. Five Tango Charlie, the center controller radioed. We have a change in routing. Ready to copy? Tango Charlie, go ahead. Five Tango Charlie is cleared via J-64 Bradford, direct Des Moines. Matthews tapped the high altitude chart. Look, we're about to cross Jet 64. Evans looked at the chart. He has to be closing from the left, westbound, if he hasn't already crossed in front of us. You're right. Let's step down, Matthews ordered. Evans eased the autopilot into a descent, then turned toward Simmons. We're going to cruise at 50,000 feet. Both pilots saw the business jet's flashing strobe lights at the same instant. Jesus! Matthews yelled as the B-2 was rocked violently by wingtip turbulence from the Citation III. His wing went right over our cockpit. Evans continued the descent as the pilots listened to the frightened Citation co-pilot. Cleveland, 5-5 Tango Charlie. Cleveland, we almost had a mid-air. You have any traffic in the vicinity at our altitude? Negative, 5-5 Tango Charlie. Closest traffic is eastbound, 8 miles at your 11 o'clock. Okay, Cleveland, but we want to report a damn close call, something, and it was definitely there, passed right under us. Matthews and Evans exchanged anxious looks before the aircraft commander turned toward Simmons. The tech rep's face was contorted in fear as he watched Evans level the stealth at 50,000 feet. 50,000 is a non-used altitude. We'll be in a safer position here. Simmons, grim-faced, nodded. The stealth bomber was 85 nautical miles north-northeast of Tallahassee, Florida. Matthews had elected to reduce power in order to conserve the rapidly dwindling fuel supply. Both pilots continuously monitored the global navigation readout showing distance to destination and time to fuel exhaustion. According to the navigation equation, Shadow 37 would flame out at 6 minutes before they reached San Julian. Larry, Matthews said, I want to ask you a question. Colonel Matthews, I am not going to discuss anything except getting this aircraft to Cuba. Okay, Larry. Just one important personal question. What happened? What caused you to even contemplate hijacking a B-2? I don't want to discuss anything. Just do as I tell you, Simmons answered, wiping his hands nervously on his flight suit. Larry, I can't imagine anything so bad that it would cause you to do something that you'll regret for the rest of your life. You two don't know what it's like to be treated like I have. You've never been kicked around. Larry, listen to me, for God's sake. The communists aren't going to have any use for you after they've gleaned all the information you can provide. They don't trust anyone, especially someone who has been disloyal to his own country. They'll kill you, Larry. You're the one weak link who would expose their hijacking. You're signing our death warrants along with yours if we don't turn back now. You are wrong, completely wrong. The Russians I work for are my friends, and I'm going to be in charge of stealth technician evaluations. Besides, I'm marrying a Russian citizen. Yeah, right. Kirtland Truesdell, the Vice President of the United States, held a phone to his ear as he motioned for Secretary of Defense Bernard Kirchner and Air Force General Frank Parkinson to join him in his study. Yes, sir. That was the President, Truesdell said. He wants us to keep him informed of any developments in the B-2 search. Also, he wants us to be at Camp David at 7 in the morning. The Vice President addressed the Defense Secretary. Bernie, how the hell did we manage to lose a B-2? They've been searching for almost 4 hours and haven't found a shred of evidence to indicate that the stealth crashed. Sir, the aircraft was scheduled to land at Ellsworth approximately 15 minutes ago. It hasn't arrived. No one has communicated with the crew. The Canadians confirm that there was an emergency code displayed briefly where the aircraft was supposed to be, and the B-1 crew hasn't shed any light on the disappearance. That's all we know. Parkinson spoke to Truesdell. Mr. Vice President, all the information indicates that the aircraft crashed into the Hudson Bay where the emergency code flashed briefly. The flight was following a very precise, pre-planned course. We'll know for certain where the aircraft crashed when we search in the morning. The crews will fly the same course, spread out horizontally at half-mile intervals. If the stealth went into the bay, sir, there will be floating debris, I can assure you. Sir, whatever happened, we believe was catastrophic. The crew never had a chance to get off a message. Let's get some sleep. Plan for 5:45 brief here, then we'll go to the helicopter pad. Evans looked at the high-altitude en route chart, then switched the VHF radio from Jacksonville Center to Miami Center. The pilots listened to the busy air traffic controllers and commercial pilots discuss the rapidly deteriorating weather. Hurricane Bennett was growing in intensity. Larry, Matthews paused, you picked a great time of the year to go to Cuba. The eye of the hurricane is passing 40 miles south of San Julian. Simmons remained quiet. He had no plan for such an eventuality. Levchenkov had not discussed any bad weather alternatives during the planning sessions. Would the MiG pilots be able to rendezvous with the stealth? Larry, we're flying into a hurricane without enough fuel to reach our destination. You must listen to reason. Colonel, we are committed to San Julian. God damn it, listen to reason. This is our last chance to land while we have fuel in our tanks. We aren't bullshitting you. Look at the nav plot, for Christ's sake, and add it up. We are committed to San Julian. Matthews uttered a curse as he pulled the number one and four throttles to idle, then cut off. Well, what are you doing? Simmons asked in shock. Shut up. We don't have any choice. It's very simple, Larry. I have to conserve fuel, so we'll fly on two engines. It's going to be a crapshoot. Here we go. Descent checklist. Simmons clutched the flare gun in both hands. Well, why are we descending? Because we can't maintain 50,000 feet on two engines. We'll have to drift down to an altitude we can hold with the power we have. Simmons remained quiet while the two pilots completed their checklists. He could feel the turbulence and rain increasing as the bomber plunged into the thick, boiling storm clouds. Stop! The MiGs are supposed to join us at 51,000. Screw the MiGs. We're trying to survive, you stupid bastard. Simmons yanked up the flare gun, then shoved the barrel into the back of Evans' neck. His hand shook. Don't screw with me, Major. Matthews turned his head. Put the gun down and hang on. This is going to be a rough ride into San Julian. Simmons lowered the flare pistol slowly, then leaned back in his seat. The darkened cockpit remained quiet as the bouncing, yawing bomber descended through 39,000 feet. Evans checked the fuel exhaustion and time to destination readout. Chuck, we're behind the curve. I know, Matthews responded without taking his eyes off the instrument displays. All I can do is keep it high, clean, and fast. We've only got one shot. Simmons, bracing against the severe turbulence, had been watching the distance to destination wind down. 137, 136, 135. I'm turning on our radar and transponder, he announced, holding the flare gun chest high. The MiGs have to find us to lead us to the airfield. Okay, Evans replied, tuning the San Julian radio beacon. Standard altitude calls? Sure, Matthews responded as he looked closely at the World Aeronautical Chart. They've only got an 8,500-foot runway, so I'll have to be right on the numbers. Evans half turned to face Simmons. Hope your comrades have the lights turned up for us. Simmons raised the shaking flare pistol, pointing it in the co-pilot's face. Keep your mouth shut, Major. Back off, Simmons, Matthews snarled. We can't go anywhere, so put down the gun. Simmons lowered the flare pistol and leaned back, frightened about the consequences of botching the hijacking. No one said a word as the stealth descended through the torrential rain and jarring turbulence. Evans peered out his side window, then flinched. We've got company, looks like a fox bat. Matthews looked out to the left. He could barely make out the Cuban MiG-25 on his side. He quickly flipped on his navigation and formation lights. Yeah, Matthews replied. I have one on this side. He has a flashlight. Looks like he's signaling something. Same here, Evans responded, pressing his face closer to the window. Looks like he's signaling to go down. Yeah, he wants us to descend. Oh, it's too early, Matthews said. We can't afford to waste the fuel. He turned to Simmons. Is there any provision to talk to the MiGs or the San Julian Tower? No, Colonel, the chalky-faced tech rep answered. They don't want any radio transmissions from the B-2. Evans looked quickly at the fuel gauges and navigation readout, then back at the side window. Sorry, comrades, we can't let down. Just the co-pilot's sentence was cut off by a burst of cannon fire from the MiG on the left side of the B-2. Oh, Christ. We're starting down. Levchenko, stealth project officer and director of the Renegade KGB operations at the San Julian, paced nervously back and forth in the control tower. The portly, bushy-haired man was the Soviet Union's highest-regarded field operative. How far are they out? Levchenko asked the senior warrant officer. 90 kilometers, comrade director. We have the runway lights at the highest intensity. Do not worry, comrade director, assured Major General Bratskarnov, commanding officer of the Soviet Air Force detachment. Lieutenant Colonel Zanyatov and Major Sokolovye are the two best pilots in the VVS. They will guide the Americans down safely. I hope you are right, General, Levchenko replied out of the corner of his mouth, for the sake of us all. Matthews, staring through the rain at the MiG-25, wrestled the controls of the bucking stealth bomber. Evans watched the fuel totalizer steadily count towards zero. Less than 1,200 pounds, Chuck. Okay, switch to land. Evans placed the master mode switch to the land position. We're down to flaps and gear. Okay, Matthews responded. 1,000 pounds, Evans reported, locking his shoulder harness restraints. We're making a left-hand approach according to the mileage and heading. I know. We've got terrain up to around 2,000 feet northeast of the field. Those bozos better have it together. This is like flying through Niagara Falls. 900 pounds. Slowing. Give me flaps. We'll hold the gear. Flaps on the way, Evans responded, straining to see through the rain-splattered windshield. Out of 1,500, showing 800 pounds, airspeed 175. Okay, Matthews replied, tight-lipped. Stand by for the gear and call out my alt. Shit! Evans interrupted. We've lost fuel pressure on number three. We're losing three. Give me crossfeed, Matthews ordered, advancing the throttle on the number two engine. Boost on. You got it, Evans shouted, monitoring the radio altimeter. 800 feet, we're bleeding off. Power. Power, Matthews advanced the number two throttle to the limit. 500 feet, 145 on the speed, Evans cautioned, squinting through the windshield. I don't see anything. Keep it coming. Simmons placed the flare gun in the leg pocket of his flight suit, then clutched his seat and closed his eyes. 300 feet, Evans reported, breathing faster. 140, bleeding off. I've got it to the stops. Both pilots flinched when the low-altitude warning alarm sounded. I've lost the MiG, Matthews shouted. He's going around. Gotta hold this heading. We're almost there. God, I hope so, Matthews answered. Airspeed, airspeed, Evans prompted. Two's fluctuating. We're losing it. 100 feet. Two's flamed out. Raise the nose. Gear down, Matthews yelled. Wind shear, Evans warned, snapping the landing gear lever down. Get that nose up. I can't control it. Evans, wide-eyed, stared through the windshield at the black void. I've got runway lights, the co-pilot shouted, bracing himself. Gear down and locked. Ease it right. Evans gripped the glare shield with both hands. Here we go. The B-2 went off the runway, right brake smoking, and plowed 2,800 feet to a shuddering stop, leaving three deep furrows in the soggy ground. Both pilots sat dazed, their hearts racing as they watched the array of vehicle lights approaching them. Well, Simmons, Matthews said, removing his camouflage helmet and flight gloves, you better step out and greet your associates. Simmons wordlessly lowered the crew entrance hatch and stepped out of the B-2's belly. Three Soviet gas field cars, each equipped with a mounted machine gun, surrounded the front of the stealth bomber. A dark brown van roared down the wet taxiway and plowed toward the B-2. A Cuban soldier jumped out of the van carrying a submachine gun. He gestured wildly for Simmons to get into the vehicle. The hijacker ran through the rain, splashing ankle-deep mud on his flight suit, and stepped through the van's sliding door. Well, Chuck, Evans said slowly, noticing the Russian motioning for them to get out. Must be our turn. I'm afraid so, Matthews replied. He exited the hatch, then Evans followed him out of the darkened cockpit. The pilots placed their hands on top of their heads and walked toward the van. A half dozen Cuban troops surrounded them. The leader, brandishing a revolver, gestured toward the van's open side door. In the car! Both pilots stepped up into the van, hands on top of their heads, then sat down across from Simmons. Just do what they say, and you'll be okay. Two Cubans climbed into the vehicle, slid the door closed, then sat down on each side of Simmons, facing the American captives. Put your hands down, the Russian ordered. We mean you no harm if you cooperate. Good morning, sir, Parkinson said as Truesdell rose from his chair. Good morning, gentlemen, the vice president responded, pointing toward the two place settings on the table. Please have a seat. Kirchner and Parkinson took their seats as Truesdell sat down and placed his napkin. Any news? Kirchner sounded unusually glum. Only that our morning search is getting underway, and we have a lot of help from the Canadians throughout the night. They provided four search vessels, but not a trace of debris has been located. Parkinson hesitated a moment, then turned to face the vice president. As I stated last evening, sir, if the B-2 went down into the bay, which seems most likely, there will be evidence floating on the surface. The gleaming Sikorsky lifted off the helicopter pad, turned away from the White House, then accelerated toward the presidential retreat. Kirk Truesdell picked up the blue leather-bound folder next to his seat and read the information concerning Shadow 37's crew. The defense secretary and General Parkinson had their own copies. Outstanding flying records and solid credentials, Truesdell commented. They appear to be excellent pilots and officers. They are, sir, Parkinson responded. General Donovan told me, in confidence, that both families are happy and well-adjusted. We don't have much information about the civilian yet, Kirchner added, but we expect the contractor to provide what they have in the next couple of hours. The Marine helicopter slowed, then descended toward the landing pad. When the main rotor blades began winding down, a Marine sergeant in dress blues opened the sliding door, then locked it into position. Truesdell, followed by Kirchner and Parkinson, stepped out of the helicopter and walked past the saluting sergeant. The President of the United States, Alton Glenn Jarrett, walked forward to greet his three guests. We have had word from General Donovan, Jarrett said as they made their way to the presidential retreat. The airborne search is underway. It has been for more than an hour, and they haven't spotted anything thus far. I don't expect they will find anything, the vice president responded, if my hunch is correct. Well, what do you mean, Kurt? Jarrett asked. Let's wait until we have some privacy, if you don't mind, sir. After the four men had settled into the president's office, Jarrett said, "Kirk, tell us what's on your mind." Truesdell reached for the writing pad on the small conference table. "I'm not as well versed about airplanes as General Parkinson," the vice president said, "but I've been a licensed pilot for more than 22 years, and this disappearance defies everything I've ever heard of, short of being swallowed by a UFO. I believe that the stealth was commandeered, hijacked."
"What?"
Kirchner said, stunned. "You believe the B-2 was stolen?"
"Yes, I do. Our stealth bomber is one of the most highly classified weapon systems we have. We know the Soviets have been trying, without much success, to develop a stealth aircraft for the past 6 years. They are undoubtedly some in the military who aren't willing to accept the loss of power. It would be a real coup to snatch a stealth aircraft."
Parkinson tensed. "Are you suggesting that our pilots would defect?"
"I'm not accusing anyone at this point, General. I have a couple of suggestions with the President's permission."
"Of course, Kirk."
"First, we need to run a thorough background check on all three men aboard the B-2. At the same time, we need to query every air traffic control center and sector in the stealth range."
"I concur," Jarrett replied, turning to his Secretary of Defense.
"Bernie, call Fred Adcock at FBI. Make it top priority. We have to have answers in a matter of hours, not days. I want them to concentrate their efforts on the civilian technician."
In their cell, Matthews and Evans could hear muted sounds coming from the hangar. Then, without warning, the heavy cell door opened with a bang, startling the two pilots.
"On your feet now. Follow me."
Matthews and Evans walked through the door into the brightly lighted hangar. Two more guards carrying AK-47 assault rifles fell in behind the Americans. Both pilots stole quick looks at the frenzied activity around the stealth bomber. A power cart had been plugged into the B-2, bringing the aircraft's systems to life. Teams of technicians swarmed over the warplane, taking notes and photographing the interior and exterior. A dozen panels had been removed from the fuselage and wings, exposing the intricacies of the bomber. They reached the entrance to the KGB director's office. Levchenkov motioned for the pilots to enter.
"Have a seat," Levchenkov said.
Matthews and Evans sat down on the long bench across from the Soviet agent. The three guards remained standing, blocking the only exit from the room.
"You will have a cigarette?"
"No, thank you."
"Well, we can make this easy, or we can make this very difficult for you. Very difficult. The choice is yours."
"We are being held captive, prisoners. You, whomever you represent, have committed a gross violation of international law."
"So, Major, you elect to make my job more difficult."
"My rank is Lieutenant Colonel, and you get nothing but name, rank, and serial number."
"That will soon change. Believe me."
"Cut the crap," Evans said. Levchenkov's watery, pale blue eyes hardened.
"You are right, Major. We will cut the crap, as you say. You will cooperate with me, or I will place you in a very undesirable environment until you change your mind."
"A gulag?"
"Correct, Colonel. A reconditioning course until you are ready to cooperate." "You will cooperate, I assure you. It is only a matter of time."
"You're wrong. We are prisoners of the Soviet Union or Cuba, and, understand clearly, we will not cooperate with you." Levchenko smiled broadly, then lashed out, backhanding Matthews into the side of his co-pilot.
"Take them to Mantua!"
Levchenkov shouted to the guards, then yanked both pilots up by the front of their flight suits.
Secretary of Defense Kirchner talked on a secure telephone as he perused a classified message. He looked up when the vice president walked into the communications room.
"The president is waiting, Barney," Truesdale said.
"Yes, sir," Kirchner replied. "Be there in a second."
Truesdale returned to the conference table. "Bernie's on his way," the vice president reported, then sat down. "Thank you," Garrett responded, turning to Parkinson. "General, what is the current status of our search effort?"
"Not a trace, Mr. President," Parkinson answered, pausing while Kirchner entered the room and seated himself.
"General, excuse me, but I have some disturbing news, I'm afraid. That was Fred Adcock on the phone. The background check on the civilian crew member disclosed a link to the KGB.
"What?"
Fred said, and I quote, Kirchner looked down at his hastily written notes, "The civilian technician, identified as one Lawrence Maynard Simmons, has categorically been linked to Irina Rykov, a known KGB agent."
"Jesus Christ, how'd that information get by the security people?"
"Apparently, from the information Fred has now, Simmons holds a top-secret clearance and has worked on the B-2 project for the past 3 years. The liaison with the KGB agent was nurtured approximately 4 to 5 months ago."
"Well, we know how the hijacking was set up. Now we need to find out where the aircraft has been taken."
The president saw the intercom light flash and depressed the switch.
"Melvin Collins, FAA, for Vice President Truesdale."
"He will take the call in here," the president replied.
The vice president swung around and raised the phone receiver.
"Hello, Mel. What have you found out?"
Jarrett, lowering his voice, spoke to the defense secretary.
"Bernie, I want that airplane back, whatever it takes, whatever we have to do."
"I understand, sir. We're going to have to..." Kirchner trailed off when the vice president placed the phone receiver down and swiveled to face the group.
"Well, gentlemen," Truesdale began, "I believe I can tell you where our stealth bomber is located at the moment.
Somewhere in Cuba.
Mel Collins said that a senior air traffic controller in the Cleveland Center reported a strange occurrence last night. A corporate jet pilot radioed a report of a near mid-air collision 70 nautical miles south of Detroit, and this is important, the controller's radar didn't show any other aircraft near the civilian jet. The civilian jet was traveling east to west, and the object passed under them from right to left, north to south."
The vice president leaned toward the officer.
"Now, how fast does the B-2 cruise?"
Parkinson thought for a second.
"Normal cruise for the B-2 is approximately 450 to 460 knots.
"I'm not following you, Kurt," the president said. "What does speed have to do with establishing the whereabouts of the B-2?
"My point," Truesdale responded, "is that the near mid-air collision happened a little over 1,000 statute miles directly south of the last known position of the B-2. Actually, the location of the emergency signal. And if you draw a line from that point to the middle of Cuba, the near mid-air is almost directly on it."
The last few minutes of daylight were fading away rapidly as the rusted, dented Chevrolet van bounced down the partially paved highway. Lieutenant Colonel Charles Matthews and Major Paul Evans sat on a bench in the back of the vehicle. Both men remained quiet, sitting angled away from each other. Their hands had been tied together behind their backs, then tied to each other. The van rounded a tree-lined corner into an open expanse of roadway surrounded by grass and stubble. Across an open field on the far side of a narrow stream was a small civilian airport.
"Paul," Matthews said under his breath, "look out to your left."
Evans glanced quickly at the four men in the forward portion of the van. One Cuban guard, sitting behind the steering wheel, was accompanied in the front seat by the chief of KGB security at San Julian. Another Cuban guard and a KGB security officer sat on opposing benches behind the front seats. Evans studied the guards for a moment, then darted a look at the small private airstrip Matthews had secretly indicated.
Both pilots had seen the two ancient, dilapidated DC-3s rotting behind the single hangar. They had also seen an old radial engine trainer sporting a huge paddle-bladed propeller.
"The Goonie Birds," Matthews said, barely moving his lips. "Aren't airworthy, but the small plane looks like it's flyable."
Matthews stopped talking when the closest KGB agent looked back at the two pilots. The short, wiry Cuban also glanced at the Americans, then resumed his animated, noisy discussion with the driver. The senior KGB agent carried a 9mm Beretta. The two men in the back held their AK-47s across their laps, seemingly unconcerned with the two disheveled Americans.
"Chuck," Evans whispered, straining against the rough ropes binding his wrists. I think I'm almost out of this lash-up. Can you move your hands further behind me?
Matthews moved his bound hands as far as he could stretch them.
Just a couple of more seconds,
Evans said.
You ready to go for him?
Damn right.
Can you get me loose?
Yeah, I think so. Just a second.
Okay.
You take the Scarface and I'll get the one on the right.
Can you pull your hands loose?
Yes, Matthews responded, feeling the cord go slack around his left wrist.
Jesus, Paul, you're amazing.
Watching the guards, he turned slightly to see Evans in his periphery.
When I say now, let's go for their weapons and shove the bastards forward. Ready? One, two, three. Now!
Both officers catapulted across the van, smashing into the two guards with brutal force. Matthews yanked the AK-47 away from the smaller man, kicking him off his bench into the back of the front passenger seat. Evans had punched the KGB agent straight in the nose and ripped his rifle loose.
Don't move,
Evans yelled, pointing the barrel into the Russian's face. The Cuban driver panicked, then slammed on the brake, sending Evans crashing over the Soviet officer into the back of the driver. Matthews fell on top of the other Cuban as the van slid to a stop.
Don't move, goddammit, Matthews shouted, pointing the assault rifle at the soldier. You okay, Paul?
Yeah, I'm fine. We're getting back, Matthews ordered, motioning for the four guards to move to the rear.
You move it, now!
The Cuban, along with the two Russians, scampered to the back of the battered Chevrolet while Evans yanked the driver between the front seats.
Stretch out, face down, Matthews ordered, shoving the startled men down on their stomachs. Side by side.
Matthews tied the quartet together quickly, then unzipped the front of his flight suit and tore off his turtleneck. He ripped the soiled pullover into four strips and gagged each man.
Paul, Matthews said, picking up his assault rifle, turn this wreck around and let's take that narrow road about three-quarters of a mile back, the one just before the airfield road. We've got to get rid of these bastards and then try the airfield.
Evans pulled over to the side of the road, cranked the wheel hard to the left, then gunned the engine.
Are you going to kill them?
No. I thought about running over their legs to immobilize them, but that...
Oh, shit,
Evans said as another vehicle rounded a curve a quarter of a mile in front of them. Grab a couple of their caps. Matthew scooped the two Cuban military hats off the floor, handing one to Evans.
Paul, if we get stopped for any reason, we've got to take our chances. We've got to shoot it out.
I know. The pilots watched the approaching vehicle.
Uh-oh, it's one of the Russian jeeps.
Keep going straight, Matthews ordered. Don't turn off the road. The Soviet Gaz field car passed the van, continued 100 meters, then rapidly slowed.
Son of a bitch,
Matthews swore under his breath.
Keep going.
The officers on the top floor of the Central Intelligence Agency, based at Langley, Virginia, were quiet. The deputy director of the CIA, David Ridgefield, waited patiently for his boss, General Norman Lashar, director of the intelligence agency, to conclude his phone call. Lashar wrote two lines on a scratch pad, tore the page loose, and handed it to a second-in-command. Ridgefield reached over, grasped the piece of paper, then sat back. He could not believe his eyes. Lashar ended his conversation and turned to his assistant.
I can't believe it either.
Ridgefield shook his head.
Renegade faction in Russia has one of our stealth bombers?
I'm afraid so, Lashar replied with a look of disgust.
Sorry to call you in at this time of the evening, but we have a major hill to take. That was Secretary Kirchner on the phone. The White House wants to use covert means to find out if the B-2 is in Cuba. We need to locate our man with 9 lives.
Will do, General, Ridgefield replied. We're going to place Wickham back in the saddle. Lashar looked Ridgefield in the eye.
No one is better qualified, in my opinion, for this kind of operation.
Turn into the airfield, Matthews ordered. They know something's wrong.
Chuck, Evans responded, swerving onto the muddy road leading to the small civilian airstrip.
Let's stop here and nail them when they come around the corner.
Okay, but we both got to open up on them.
Hang on, Evans shouted as he viciously jammed on the brakes.
As the Chevrolet ground to a halt, both pilots jumped out and crouched down in the muddy roadway.
Go for the windshield, Matthews ordered. We have to make this count.
14 seconds elapsed before the Soviet field car lurched through the corner, slid toward the edge of the road, then straightened.
Now!
Matthews barked.
The guy swerved to the right into a spray of glass, spun around to the left, then slid to a stop. The driver, badly wounded, fell out of the vehicle and crawled a dozen feet before collapsing. Let's check it. Back me up, Paul. I'm right beside you. We better see it. Shit! Both men fired simultaneously when the other Cuban and the guys lunged for the mounted machine gun. God damn it, Matthews shouted, watching the soldier slide down into the field car. Let's move it! The pilots threw their weapons into the Chevrolet. Evans jumped into the driver's seat while Matthews pulled the four guards out of the van. He left the bruised men laying in the spongy mud and crawled into the passenger seat. Evans stomped on the accelerator. The van slewed sideways, then plowed onto the slippery road. The van hit the edge of the slightly raised tarmac, bounced a foot into the air, landed it with a jolt, and shuddered to a stop. Evans and Matthews, carrying the guards, AK-47s, leaped out of the Chevrolet and raced toward the Soviet Yakolev Yak-18. The Soviet State Industries manufactured trainer circa 1957 squatted on its tricycle landing gear. Let's hope we can get it started, Matthews said. Both pilots slid back their respective canopies, jumped in, and fastened their webbed seatbelts. What a bucket of bolts, Matthews remarked as he surveyed the antiquated, well-worn cockpit. There must be some kind of a master switch in here. Come on, Chuck. I'm trying. I need a goddamn flashlight. Suddenly the silence was shattered when machine gun fire ripped into the Chevrolet van. Oh, shit, that's gonna come from the field car. The son of a bitch is still alive. Matthews frantically flipped two more switches, then another. Nothing happened. Oh, mother of Jesus, Matthews said, gritting his teeth as another burst of gunfire tore into the van. Come on, Evans shouted, peeking over the edge of the canopy rail. The bastard is coming up the road. I'm trying, Matthews yelled, toggling another switch. The cockpit came to life as gyros spun up, pumps surged, and a low hum settled over the interior. Go! Let's go! Matthews toggled the starter. Come on, baby, Matthews said under his breath. Do it for us. The big nine-cylinder air-cooled 260-horsepower Ivchenko AI-14R radio cranked over slowly. Shit, Evans swore, yanking his canopy backward to the open position. He raised his AK-47 and fired his last seven rounds at the approaching field car, then tossed the rifle over the side. Matthews had the propeller turning and was pumping the throttle slightly when the machine gun rounds ripped into the left wing. The laboring engine coughed twice, belched a cloud of white smoke from the exhaust stack, then settled into an uneven idle. Go! Evans shouted. The Yak-18 surged forward as Matthews shoved the throttle halfway open, then stomped on the right rudder pedal. Evans tossed out the second rifle and slammed his canopy closed as the lumbering aircraft slid sideways onto the dark runway. Matthews shoved the throttle all the way forward. The cold engine hesitated, backfired twice, then surged to full power. Come on, come on, Matthews urged, watching the airspeed needle move upward. We don't have much runway left. Go! Go! The Yak-18 was beginning to feel light, ready to fly, when several machine gun rounds tore into the right wing and fuselage. Two more shells sliced through the right main gear, exploding the tire. Matthews cursed as he kicked left rudder, pulled back on the stick, and banked the struggling trainer to the left. The aircraft staggered, then straightened out as he fought the controls. Hang in there, Evans encouraged. Get the nose down. Matthews had already started easing the stick forward. The aircraft accelerated to normal climb airspeed. You did it, Evans screamed over the roaring engine. God damn him, you did it! Matthews did not reply as he smoothly banked the straining aircraft, then rolled out on a northeasterly heading. Key West, Florida, Matthews reasoned, would be the closest sanctuary. The Cuban soldier, bleeding profusely from the hip and shoulder wounds, cursed the fleeing aircraft. The small man grabbed the radio microphone and screamed into it. I need help, quick, the radio crackled. Repeat, por favor, the soldier shouted. Escape! Three times, then calmed enough to tell how the Americans had gotten away and what direction they had taken. Matthews eased back the throttle and lowered the Yak's nose as they skirted along the coastline 100 feet off the water. Matthews studied the worn cockpit. No radios or navigation gear, he noted, then checked the engine instruments. Uh-oh, he said to himself, then turned to his co-pilot. We don't have any oil pressure. Noam Lachar understands the urgency, Kirchner reported to the president. and the sensitivity of the situation. Jarrett said, "We have to have confirmation and location, or our hands are tied. I intend to find the B-2 and retrieve it, or destroy it. Bernie, what about the agent, I've forgotten his name, who Lazar wants to drop in Cuba?"
"Wickham," Kirchner answered.
"Steve Wickham." "Ah, yes. He did a magnificent job rescuing our Kremlin mole when that Russian madman was about to destroy the world."
Steve Wickham, former Marine Corps captain and decorated combat veteran of the Grenada invasion, was a minor legend in the Central Intelligence Agency. The rugged, dark-haired, 6-foot-1-inch agent was considered a real-life hero. Wickham had been reassigned to clandestine operations after he had recuperated from injuries sustained during the Moscow rescue. Kirchner continued, "General Lazar believes that Wickham should reconnoiter the island, actually the location of the bomber, if we can ferret out the information before we confront the Soviets."
"I agree. And we need to move fast and aggressively."
"See if there are any life jackets back there," Matthew shouted over the roar of the big radio. "I'm going to circle close to shore in case the engine quits."
Evan searched frantically.
"Nothing back here. Anything up front?"
"No," Matthew said, tapping the oil pressure gauge. It continued to indicate zero pressure. "We may have taken a round in the oil line."
"Chuck, the gauge could be faulty. Let's take our chances and get the hell away from here."
"Okay. And one more circle and we'll head for Key West. We've got plenty of fuel." Matthews banked the Yak 18 to the left, then rolled out on the northeasterly heading. The Air Force pilot flew the Yak 18 along the Cuban coast, skirting the coastline at an altitude of 100 feet. Evans leaned forward in his seat. "I'll handle the nav and you can watch the alt." Both pilots were caught off guard when the Yak 18's rumbling Ichevko radial engine surged, coughed, backfired repeatedly, then surged again.
"Son of a bitch," Matthew swore as he jockeyed the throttle. "Keep running. Come on, do it for us."
"Well, what happened?" Evan shouted. His face was drained of color and he had a death grip on the instrument panel glare shield.
"I don't know. Maybe it took a slug of water through the fuel line."
Matthews monitored the vibrating engine instruments. RPMs remained steady. Temperature stayed in the green, but still no oil pressure. He raised his gaze, looking around the moonlit sky, then focused on the cluster of stars he had been using for navigation. Something had moved in the sky, something very fast.
"Oh, my God," the pilot said to himself.
He yanked open his canopy, straining to hear over the roar of the howling radial engine.
"Paul, they're on us. We've got fighters overhead."
"Shit," Evans exclaimed, scanning the star-filled sky. He quickly spotted the MiGs.
"They're slowing, coming over the top from the right. We're going down, right on the deck."
Lieutenant Colonel Igor Zenyentov, in rumpled street clothes and smelling of rum, listened closely to the Cuban radar controller's instructions. Zenyentov checked the spacing between himself and his wingman, Major Sokolvai, then rolled gently into a shallow bank to the left. The Russian pilot knew that he had to be successful in thwarting the Americans' bold escape. The message had been clear. If the American pilots were not brought back alive, though their operational and technical knowledge could be gained, Zenyentov and Sokolvai had no reason to return.
"I see the aircraft."
"Yes, off your right wing, Colonel, just forward of the wingtip."
Zenyentov searched the area, scanning back and forth, then saw the Yak 18 low over the water.
"Yes, I have them," Zenyentov acknowledged, steepening his descent.
Zenyentov set his armament panel switches, then selected his two 23-millimeter guns. He keyed his radio.
"Major Sokolvai, I am descending for a firing pass. Remain in high cover."
"Yeah, Colonel. Be careful."
Zenyentov, rapidly approaching the fleeing Americans, pressed lightly on the firing button.
"Here he comes,"
Matthews shouted over the screaming radial engine.
"God damn it, we're not turning back."
Red tracer rounds spewed out of the fox bat, flashed by the side of the trainer,
arced out in front, then disappeared in the distance. "Stay low," Evans yelled, watching the MiG-25 approach, "and start jinking." Matthews watched his altitude closely. "Hang on," he warned. "Here goes." The desperate pilot pushed the control stick to the left, turning in knife-edged flight directly at the MiG-25. The roar of the thundering turbojets was ear-splitting as the Yak-18 passed 20 feet below the MiG. Matthews guided the Yak-18 through a series of skidded turns, slips, and porpoise maneuvers while maintaining the general heading to the Key West. He looked over his left shoulder again, then side-slipped the Yak close to the water. The Foxbat pilot wrapped the fighter around in a tight turn, continuing to slow, then eased the nose towards the fleeing trainer. The MiG pilot was in perfect guns position. "Hang on," Matthews cautioned as he rolled the low-flying Yak-18 into a 70-degree right turn and chopped the power to idle. The deacceleration was instantaneous. Straining under the G-loading, Matthews looked over his right shoulder as the MiG-25 snapped into a tight right turn, stalled, then slammed into the water a split second after the afterburners were lighted. The Foxbat exploded into a blinding flash as cold water rammed through the air intakes into the red-hot turbojets. "You suckered him in! You did it!" Matthews added power and leveled the wings, then looked up and scanned the dark sky. "Where's the other MiG? I've lost him." Okay, I've got him," Evans responded, tightening his seatbelt. 4 o'clock, and coming down fast." Sokolvay, adrenaline pumping through his veins, was in a frenzy. He was driven to stop the wily Americans any way possible and avenge the death of his flight leader. The Yak-18 was only 3 kilometers ahead of Sokolvay when the fighter pilot lowered the MiG's nose. "Kiss your asses goodbye, you clever bastards," Sokolvay said under his breath when the ready-to-fire light glowed. "Come on. Track." Sokolvay raised the MiG's nose a couple of degrees, then rolled into a gentle right turn to line up with the tail of the Yak-18. "Got it," Sokolvay said triumphantly as he squeezed off the air-to-air missile. "Break right! Break right! Missile!" Evans screamed. Matthews groaned under the snap G-load he forced on the trainer. The Yak-18, in knife-edged flight, changed course 90 degrees in 3 seconds. "Coming back," Matthews said in a strained voice. "We gotta stay down." The pilot's statement was cut off by a flash and a deafening explosion 40 yards in front of the aircraft. The AA-7 Apex had missed the trainer and impacted the water, detonating with a thunderous roar. "Oh, shit," Matthews swore as he leveled the wings and yanked back the stick. The Yak-18 flew through the geyser of water and debris, staggered, shuddered, then dropped off on the right wing. "Hang on," Matthews shouted, chopping the throttle. "We're going in." Both pilots grabbed their glare shields and braced themselves for the impact. The Yak-18's right wingtip sliced into the water, sending the trainer into a cartwheeling, end-over-end crash landing. The crumpled fuselage, missing the right wing and 3 feet of the left wing, came to rest inverted. Matthews yanked repeatedly at his seatbelt, thrashing from side to side. Finally, when his lungs felt as though they had been set on fire, the pilot freed himself and struggled out of the sinking aircraft. He kicked off from the side of the cockpit and crawled his way upward. Gasping and sucking air, he broke the surface and looked around frantically for Paul Evans. "Paul!" Matthew shouted, treading water and turning constantly. He could taste the foul, greasy aviation fuel. "Paul!" Matthews gulped more air and dove below the surface. He fought his way downward in the pitch-black water, felt the stub of a propeller blade, then crawled along the side of the mangled fuselage. He passed the front cockpit and reached into the rear seat. His left hand touched Evans' arm, then moved up to his face. His face had slammed into the instrument panel, breaking his neck. Matthews tugged at Evans' seatbelt. The locking device opened easily, and Matthews pulled on Evans' torso. He yanked repeatedly on his co-pilot, then realized that Evans was trapped in the twisted cockpit. Matthews, in agony and frustration, and feeling the onslaught of the oxygen starvation, let go of his close friend and shot for the surface. The pilot treaded water instinctively while his lungs heaved in an effort to suck in air. He felt his head clear rapidly and his strength return. 4 seconds later, Matthews heard the combined sounds. They had been there all along, the MiG-25 overhead and the approaching Soviet helicopter, but he had blocked them out in his mental trauma. "You sons of bitches," Matthews bellowed, watching the approaching searchlight from the rescue helicopter.
Levchenko anxiously waited at the control tower for the rescue helicopter to return. The tower chief, Pogostin, had just sent word that the helicopter was 9 minutes out.
Comrade director, the helicopter pilot reports only one American survivor.
We only need one. And what condition is he in?
He is reported to have suffered only cuts and bruises.
Excellent,
Levchenko spat, turning to the ranking KGB officer now in charge of security.
Talofokine, come here.
Ja, comrade director, the security expert said.
You will personally be responsible for the confinement of the American. I don't care if you have to guard him yourself 24 hours a day. Do you understand me?
Yes, clearly, comrade director.
If there is one screw-up, I will see that you spend the rest of your miserable career as a clerk on the peninsula in Siberia.
The agent swallowed, then nodded his understanding.
Meet the helicopter and escort the prisoner to the hangar.
The captain of the Power catamaran waited along with his 13 scuba diving enthusiasts for one of their companions to complete his telephone conversation. The catamaran had cast off scant seconds before the Mirage's courtesy van had slid to a grinding halt at the dock. The ensemble had watched curiously as the tanned American leaped from the catamaran to the pier and run the short distance to the shouting messenger.
I'll go see what the problem is, Rebecca Marchand offered, stepping onto the wooden deck.
Thanks, mate,
the captain responded, admiring the beautiful blonde-haired young woman. She was only 20 feet from the small passenger shelter when her fiancé, Stephen Wickham, raced out the door.
Becky, we have to cancel. I'll explain later.
Well, what's wrong, Steve?
I'm not sure exactly, he answered. Let's grab our gear.
Steve and Becky trotted down to the waiting catamaran, apologized to the skipper and their fellow passengers, retrieved the rented diving gear, then hurried back to the Sheridan's passenger shuttle.
Honey, I have to go back, Steve said. Some kind of crisis at the agency.
You've got to be kidding,
Becky responded.
Becky, I know this isn't fair to you, but something very important, really big, has happened. I honestly don't know the particulars, but it's a Category 1 panic.
Well, can't they assign someone else? You're on vacation, and we've only been here 3 days.
Hey, kiddo, I know you're upset, but it isn't as simple as it sounds.
The van stopped at the entrance to the hotel. Steve followed Becky to their room, closed the door, and turned to her.
Honey, do you want to stay over for a couple of days?
No, I want to be with you. We'll go back together, and I can spend some time in Washington.
Becky, it isn't that easy. I won't be going back on the airline, and I won't be going to Langley.
Okay, Steve. Out with it.
Becky, I haven't explained to you what I'm doing at the present time in the agency. I was reassigned to clandestine ops after I came back from recuperative leave.
Clandestine ops? That sounds like a nice, safe, long-term career position.
Honey, I promise we'll talk about the alternatives when I get home, okay?
I'll bet you tell that to all the girls. How long until they pick you up?
Steve looked at his watch. About 2 hours.
Well, Becky said as she untied her cover-up and let it drop to the floor, let's enjoy the time we have.
Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Matthews, bruised, battered, and full of anguish over the loss of his co-pilot and best friend, looked around the hangar cell. Forcing himself to relax, he walked over to the rumpled bunk and sat down. The cell door opened abruptly to admit the stealth project director, accompanied by the KGB security officer and 3 Cuban soldiers. Matthews met Levchenkov's eyes with a cold, unblinking stare. Matthews stood slowly, not taking his eyes off Levchenko's face. His hair was matted, and he had dried blood on his left temple and ear and under his cheek. Levchenko turned toward Talofokine.
Hand me the list.
The KGB officer stepped forward and gave Levchenko 3 pieces of paper stapled together.
Now, Lieutenant Colonel Matthews, you will answer these questions. If we discover that you have lied about any of them, well, let us say it will not be in your best interest.
We've been through this before, or have you forgotten? Levchenko smiled crookedly, then karate chopped Matthews. The two Cuban guards rushed forward and placed the barrels of their AK-47s on Matthews' neck.
I told you before that we can make it easy or we can make it difficult. Which will it be, Colonel Matthews?
Well, since we're talking about torture, why don't I just go ahead and give you goons a reason to kill me?
They won't kill you, Colonel, until I have the information I need. And we don't have to torture you. We use a much more sophisticated system.
Drugs?
That's correct. You will tell us every detail you know about this stealth, along with the operational data and your command's warfare philosophy. You won't remember a thing, so don't be stupid and stubborn.
Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Matthews sat back in the hard, rough chair and watched the Soviet medical technician prepare the syringes. Matthews was bound to the heavy chair with wide leather wrist straps.
Shall we proceed, Colonel?
Levchenko asked as he motioned for the technician to inject Matthews with the drug. The skinny Russian pulled up the sleeve of Matthews' flight suit and placed a rubber tourniquet around his right bicep. The specialist picked up a freshly opened syringe and leaned over the pilot.
God damn it, Matthews snapped,
then winced again when the technician shoved the needle in further. Levchenko looked at the B-2 aircraft commander, sat down in a chair, lit a Pall Mall, then turned on a Panasonic cassette tape recorder.
Tell me about the materials that make up the leading edge of your bomber.
My name is Lieutenant Colonel Charles Edward Matthews, United States Air Force. I have been drugged and coerced to compromise my country.
Matthews continued to talk, appearing to be alert and cognizant. His mind, however, failed to record the conversation. Levchenko interrogated Matthews for more than 2 hours, stopping only to allow the medical technician to inject more drug. Matthews outlined the operating perimeters of the B-2, including the dash speed, absolute altitude, range without aerial refueling, armament capability, and maximum load. During the second hour, Levchenko had Matthews explain the tactical advantages of the super-secret bomber. After he was through, Levchenko waved the thin medical technician over to Matthews.
Stay with him until he has recovered. I will send in the guards.
Yeah, Comrade Director.
Levchenko turned off the recorder, retrieved the two tapes, ground out his cigarette, and walked into his office. He placed the tapes carefully in their original containers, then into watertight bags. After sealing the bags, he placed them in metal containers and locked the square boxes in his desk. Steve Wickham sat in the passenger cabin of the C-20 VIP aircraft, listening to Hampton Milligan, director of the CIA clandestine operations. The former Green Beret officer was pointing out various topographical features on a large relief map of Cuba.
Steve, Milligan began, this comes right from the top. The president has ordered us to recon two specific areas in Cuba, and the general has commissioned you to do it.
Alone. Two questions. Why me, when we have a number of clandestine agents who are Hispanic? And what am I looking for?
Steve, when the general gives an order, we pick up our packs and move out. You speak fluent Spanish along with Russian, and you are the man.
Fine, but what gives?
Your mission is to locate a missing B-2 stealth bomber.
What? The Cubans have a stealth?
We have every indication that the aircraft is in Cuba. Read this thoroughly, then we'll go over the details.
Wickham studied the agency operations brief. His eyes grew wide at each new paragraph.
This is incredible. Absolutely incredible. I'm expected to snoop a military airfield?
You're going in tonight.
But, Ham, I can't just go waltzing around Cuba. Hell, I'll stick out like a sore thumb.
Milligan did not respond.
Ham, I'm a green-eyed Caucasian.
The director of clandestine operations gave Wickham a blank stare.
A Caucasian who speaks Spanish and is very innovative under pressure.
Hamp, how are you proposing to insert me?
You can stage out of Cancun tonight. A young captain will fly you across the Yucatan Channel and drop you a mile off Bahia de Guadiana.
You'll go in, Milligan stopped to point out the exact spot on the large Cuban map.
Right here. We figure you can make the base by sunrise, dig in for the day, then recon the field the following night.
Well, wait a second. Back to the drop. We're going to need some diversionary tactics.
We're going to cram the channel with a plethora of aircraft. Your pilot is going to be skimming the water all the way in. No way they can pick you up on radar. We've got a lot to do, so let's get underway. We're going to fly you to Cancun in a chartered jet, then prepare you for the drop. By the way, don't shave. We're going to transform you into a gnarled farm worker. Steve Wickham sat on the DC-9's cockpit jump seat and watched the airport pass off to his left. Wickham's mind drifted back to his conversation with the director of clandestine operations. More to the point, to the final topic of the covert operation brief, the method to be used to extract Wickham from Cuba. We're going to use the Skyhook to pick you up offshore the third night, if all goes according to plan. Approximately 30 minutes before Wickham was to reach the beach, which was estimated to be 0400 to 0430, the agent would send the signal for extraction. If the time was later than 0500, the pullout would have to be postponed until the following night. After sending the extraction signal, Wickham would slip back into his wetsuit. Next, he would don a special parachute harness connected to a 200-foot-long bungee cord. The tough, elastic cord was attached to a 14-foot-long, thin nylon line with a modified weather balloon on the end. After Wickham made his way out to sea, he would wait until he heard the OV-10, then pop the seal on the small cylinder of compressed helium attached to the balloon. The balloon would inflate to approximately 8 feet in diameter, carrying the strong elastic cord up 200 feet. At the end of the elastic cord, beneath a softball-sized rubber attachment, was a large Cyalum chemical light stick. The OV-10 pilot would be able to see the bright light stick from a distance of 5 to 8 miles. So would the Cubans. The risky extraction would have to be swift and flawless. When the pilot spotted the eerie-looking light, he would head straight for it. He would warn the winch operator in the back, then begin slowing to 100 knots. The pilot would drop to 75 feet of altitude in order to be below the light and the rubber stop at the end of the tough elastic cord. The wide, heavy-duty steel fork mounted through the nose of the aircraft would engage the elastic cord approximately 50 feet below the light. Wickham would start accelerating through the water at a fairly rapid pace, then be snatched out quickly after the line stretched and recoiled. All well and good, Wickham thought, as the DC-9 flared for landing, as long as the line did not touch either of the two spinning propellers. The pilot would have to fly perfectly straight until Wickham was safely inside the aircraft. The jet slowed rapidly, turned off the runway, and taxied smoothly past the terminal building. Wickham unbuckled his seat restraints after the cargo jet rolled to a smooth stop in front of a small, pale green hangar. The two sliding doors were open 3 feet, revealing the camouflaged nose of the OV-10, counterinsurgency operations aircraft. Wickham could see a small group of people standing in the hangar. They were all staring at him. He hesitated, then started toward the open doors when a man in a sage green flight suit stepped out into the sun.
"Welcome to our tropical paradise," pilot said as he extended his hand. "I'm Greg Spidell, Captain U.S. Marine Corps."
Wickham shook Spidell's hand.
"Steve Wickham."
"You hungry?"
Spidell asked as the CIA agent stepped forward to greet Wickham.
"Actually, I could use a beer." "Got some of that, too. We'll keep it cold until you're back."
Marine Captain Greg Spidell taxied the sinister-looking olive-drab North American Rockwell OV-10D Bronco to the end of runway 12. Steve Wickham sat alone in the cramped compartment behind him below the cockpit. Wickham, uncomfortable in his wetsuit, sat on a sliding seat mounted flat on the floor. Greg Spidell would inform him when to unbuckle and prepare for the paradrop. Spidell shoved the twin engine throttles forward as the camouflaged Bronco accelerated rapidly down the runway. Wickham watched the runway drop away, then felt the landing gear bang into the wheel wells.
He could see the last purple and gold rays of the shimmering tropical sun sinking below the horizon. Spidell turned north and remained on course to Pensacola, Florida, until he was out of sight. At that point, he dropped to 100 feet over the smooth water and turned east towards Cuba. The Bronco would not be visible to radar at their transition altitude. Wickham sat with his arms folded on top of his equipment pack. The waterproof equipment bag connected to Wickham's chest straps contained worn-looking dark khaki trousers and a soiled green peasant shirt. A tattered straw hat and scuffed work boots completed the outfit. Wickham also carried a 9mm X-cam with a clip containing 15 rounds, along with a Berbeau tactical knife. Cushioned inside the clothing were two very important items, a small transmitter to signal for his extraction, and a compact Sony television camera. The lightweight camera had a built-in power pack capable of generating a continuous picture for 8 to 10 minutes. Provided he could locate the stealth bomber, Wickham would be able to send real-time photos of the B-2 via satellite. The last piece of equipment was a small hydrogen-powered tow vehicle. It would take him to the beach from 1 mile offshore. Returning to his extraction point would expend the limited fuel and require him to swim most of the way. Wickham keyed his intercom. "Let me know when you're 5 minutes from the drop." "Will do," Spidell replied from the darkened cockpit. Spidell lowered the OV-10's nose. "I'm stepping down to 75 feet. I'll take her down on the deck in a couple of minutes." "You're the expert," Wickham responded as he slipped on his swim fins. "Just don't doze off." "We're 5 minutes out," Greg Spidell said sometime later over the intercom. He was concentrating intently on remaining 30 feet above the calm sea. "Okay," Wickham replied, steeling himself for the night parachute jump. "I'll unstrap at the one-minute mark." The camouflaged Bronco raced across the sea at full power, black against the dark water. He searched for any sign of boats or low-flying aircraft, then checked his position. 2 minutes to go. He glanced ahead at the surface of the water and watched for a sign of land. "Oh, shit!" Spidell exclaimed to himself as he noticed the white mast light of a small boat off to his right. Too late now. He continued on course, watching the time and searching for the beach.
1 minute, Steve," Spidell warned.
"All set," Wickham replied as he unstrapped his restraining harness. He could feel the aircraft decelerating.
30 seconds, Steve. Good luck."
"Thanks," Wickham replied, clamping his mouth shut and removing the Clark headset. Spidell stared at the shore, judging it to be a mile and a quarter from the drop point. He paused a second, checked his speed at 210 knots, then eased back on the stick. Wickham flew out the back at 200 feet and stopped in midair when the parachute popped open. The chute deployment at more than 200 miles per hour sounded like a shotgun blast. Wickham waited until he judged the sea to be about 30 feet below him, then unstrapped his parachute risers and plunged into the cool water. The violent impact almost tore off his right swim fin. Wickham sputtered as he resurfaced. After swimming 20 yards, he rolled on his back and rested as he watched the parachute sink beneath the sea. His thick wetsuit provided as much flotation as a small life vest. He listened for a moment, hearing only the OV-10 departing to the northwest. He secured his swim fin, then unstrapped the water tow vehicle. He looked around, pointed the water tow, then focused on the beach and pulled the trigger on the right handle. He slowed to a halt 40 yards from the gently sloping beach. His swim fins touched bottom in what Wickham figured to be about 4 feet of water. The agent purged the salt water from his nostrils and mouth and listened for any sign of activity. Pulling the trigger again, he aimed for a wide stretch of sand leading to a large guava thicket. When he felt his knees drag bottom, Wickham stopped, slipped off his fins, and walked ashore. He hurried across the beach, carrying his fins and tow vehicle, then slowed at the edge of the sand dunes adjacent to the guava thicket. He stripped off the wetsuit, opened his sealed equipment bag, and changed into the dry peasant clothing. After tying his boots, he concealed his gear carefully, strapped his tactical knife to the calf of his right leg, then placed the 9mm X-cam into the holster at the small of his back. Wickham looked at his watch, unstrapped it, and placed it in his shirt pocket. He checked his small compass and dropped it in the pocket, too. He felt confident that he could traverse the distance to San Julian by 3 a.m. He placed the small, lightweight satellite transmitter in a pocket of his baggy khaki trousers and donned his tattered straw hat. He slid the compact television camera into the specially sewn pocket in his pants, checked his camouflage tow vehicle and wetsuit, then set off for the Cuban airbase. President Jarrett, looking haggard and irritable, sat behind his desk. Samuel Gardner and Bernard Kirchner sat at opposite ends of the sofa. Well, the son of a bitch is consistent, Jarrett spat. Late, as usual. Gardner nodded in agreement. It's a game, sir. He has to convince you that his time is more important than yours.
I apologize, gentlemen.
Sergei Aksenhoff, the Russian foreign minister, said in an orchestrated display of rushing to remove his overcoat.
Mr. Aksenhoff, I have received some very distressing news in regard to American-Soviet relations. We have been advised that Russia, actually a faction of the KGB, is responsible for commandeering, hijacking one of our B-2 bombers.
Aksenhoff remained poker-faced.
Furthermore, Jarrett continued harshly, the bomber is in Cuba, a Soviet satellite, and I intend to recover the aircraft if it is not released immediately.
Yeah, Mr. President, gentlemen, your accusation is preposterous, outrageous,
Gardner said straight up.
God damn it, Sergei, we're past the point of pretending that the Soviet Union isn't involved.
I insist you notify your superiors in Moscow now. We are going to recover the aircraft or destroy it. Aksenhoff remained silent, but his mind was spinning. He knew nothing of the hijacking. Did the Kremlin know? He would have to contact them immediately. The president was speaking to him.
Mr. Aksenhoff, it is up to you. We want to know what the Soviet position is in this affair, and we want our bomber back.
Mr. President, gentlemen, I can only convey your message.
I will expect an answer, the president said, by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, Washington time.
Steve Wickham hurried along the barren road, passing a number of dilapidated shacks. He slowed to a cautious walk when he glimpsed the lights of a military airfield. He hurried toward the base, then stopped at the edge of the tree line 50 yards from the perimeter fence. He looked up and down the barbed wire barrier, which he judged to be about 4 feet high. The agent was surprised by the lack of guard towers, and he did not see any sign of perimeter sentries. The end of the runway was less than 300 yards from the fence. Wickham could see MiG fighters lined up on the ramp in front of the control tower. He studied the ramp and the two hangars. Inside each hangar, a crew of maintenance personnel was busy working on the MiGs. 4 sentries patrolled the 2 hangars, and another 2 guards walked the line of MiGs. Christ, Wickham thought. Looking at the wooden barracks and other buildings, there's no place to conceal a stealth bomber. His thoughts turned to retracing his route when he noticed the baseball park. It sat on a rise off to the south of the main section of the base. Something seemed strange about the park, but Wickham did not grasp the oddity at first. Then it struck him. Why, at this hour of the early morning, would the bright field lights be on? The agent decided to investigate. He approached the perimeter fence and examined the barbed wire closely. Noting a small strand of wire wrapped around the top line, he reasoned that it had been electrified. He backed 15 feet from the fence, inhaled deeply, then raced toward the barrier and high-jumped over the top strand. He landed on his back and rolled to a sitting position, then stood and brushed himself off.
Wickham jogged along the edge of the fence until it made a right turn. At that point he paused, listening and looking for any signs of activity, before heading toward the open field leading to the ballpark. He counted 3 guards in and around the tiered seats. Why would armed guards be patrolling a fully lighted ballpark in the wee hours of the morning? He hurried across the field, darting between palm trees until he was 60 feet from the west end of the bleachers. Wickham dropped to a prone position and crawled under the bleachers and rested a moment. As his breathing slowed, he heard a peculiar sound. It reminded him of an attic fan or commercial heat ventilator. It appeared to come from close to the dugout. Wickham inched forward, then stopped abruptly as he saw the telltale signs of a photocell security system. He grabbed a pinch of loose dirt and tossed it between the sensors. The powdery particles were illuminated in the beam of light. He stood, then gingerly stepped over the beam of light. He could see a metal grate under the bleachers at the very edge of the steel supports. Hot, humid air was being forced up through the iron bars. The stealth was under the baseball field. Wickham eased forward to the iron bars, checked the positions of the sentries, then lifted the heavy grate cautiously. He swung his legs carefully over the edge of the opening, dropped into the shaft, and lowered the cover. He leaned down, then froze like a statue, swearing under his breath. There in front of him, not 30 feet away, was the missing B-2 stealth bomber. Wickham extracted the compact Sony television camera as he surveyed the interior of the hangar. Four guards surrounded the bomber while two other sentries walked around the perimeter of the enclosure. Six technicians dressed in powder blue smocks worked in teams of two at different places on the stealth aircraft. The agent checked the small camera and took the thin antenna out of its padded container. Wickham extended the antenna up through the grate, then maneuvered it between the bleacher seats. He dropped to his knees, steadied himself, aimed the camera, then pressed the button. The duty watch officer was sitting in front of a row of blank television screens when the transmission announcer beeped three times, indicating that an imminent television signal would appear on the screens. A moment later, a slightly blurred image of the stealth bomber appeared on three television monitors. "Oh, good God," he said to his assistant. He's in there. Look at this." His friend hurried to the bank of monitors and let out a whistle. "Hit the tape." "Got it," the officer replied. "Call the comm chief." "I'm dialing now," the wide-eyed assistant responded, mesmerized by the picture on the screens. The resolution was only fair, but the B-2 was clearly visible. "Jesus," the officer said. "We've got to get a tape to the White House on the double." The bored Cuban guard standing near third base buttoned his fly, hitched up his assault rifle, and turned to resume his monotonous patrol duty. He ambled across the slightly raised mound and continued toward first base. He was about to step on the bag when his eye caught something move. He stopped and scanned the bleachers. Sure enough, there was a small, thin strip of metal protruding through the stadium seats. The Cuban soldier approached the end of the bleachers cautiously. Had the Soviet technicians added something new to their array of gadgets? He walked between the dugout and the end of the stands, stepped under the stadium, and flipped on his flashlight. Directly in front of him, not 2 meters away, was a sliver of metal sticking out of the ventilation duct. Odd, he thought, as he stepped closer to peer through the iron gate. Steve Wickham, concentrating intently on slowly moving the camera from the front of the B-2 to the back, sensed danger, then caught the flicker of light. He placed the camera down and turned around in the cramped space. He could feel his heartbeat surge when he saw the soldier step over the grate, lean down, and point the flashlight into the duct. "Uh-oh," the watch officer said, feeling uneasy. "We've got a problem. I've lost the feed." His assistant, holding the phone to his ear, rolled his chair over to the monitors. "Oh, what happened?" "I don't know," the officer answered, staring at the blank screens. "He was giving us a long sweep when the picture angled down and went blank." Wickham braced himself, then exploded upward, slamming the heavy iron grate into the Cuban's face. The adrenaline-fueled effort smashed the soldier's nose, broke three of his teeth, and rendered him semi-conscious. The guard stumbled backward, then fell between the photocell security system. A high-pitched siren immediately blasted the quiet night with a pulsating shriek. Wickham leaped out, yanked up the television camera, grabbed the squirming guard's rifle, and raced toward the palm tree-studded field. The agent stopped suddenly when bright searchlights winked on around the perimeter of the airbase. He dropped to the ground and searched frantically for a way out. Seconds passed before he realized he was trapped. In desperation, Wickham jumped to his feet and ran toward the nearest cluster of administration buildings. President Jarrett walked into the Oval Office wearing a navy blue robe over his gray pajamas. The groggy president sat down on one of the two facing sofas. The National Security Advisor, looking rumpled and tired, returned to a seat next to Bernard Kirshner. The Secretary of Defense rubbed his bloodshot eyes before speaking to the President. "Is Sam joining us?" Jarrett nodded. "Sam is on his way over. Should be here any minute." "Good," Kirshner replied. The President settled into the sofa. "When will we have a copy of the B-2 tape?" "I expect it to be here in a few minutes, sir." The men heard an exchange of voices outside the main entrance to the Oval Office. Thank you, the Secretary of State said to the military courier as he grasped the tape container. Samuel Gardner closed the door and turned to the president. Sir, Aksenhoff is on his way. National Security Advisor Brian Gaines accepted the tape from Gardner. He walked to the VCR, inserted the tape, and punched the play button. The small screen remained blank a few seconds, then the stealth bomber appeared in a well-lighted hangar. The black-and-white picture focused on the aircraft, then moved to the right and swept the entire enclosure. Soldiers and technicians surrounded the secret bomber. A few seconds later, the picture returned to the stolen B-2, moving slowly from one section to the other. The nose of the stealth came into view. Then there was a pause before the picture moved down the length of the bomber. A split second before the aircraft's tailing edge would come into view, the picture stopped a moment, then tilted down and went blank. Well, I'll be damned. Brian, run that back.
Yes, sir.
Garrett turned to his Secretary of Defense.
Bernie, I believe we should assault San Julian with a Marine Expeditionary Unit. The Marines have to hit quickly, secure the airfield, destroy the bomber, and rescue the pilots if they can locate them. Let's use a combination of carrier attack aircraft and Air Force bombers. Do you have any qualms about that?
No, sir, none whatsoever, Kirchner answered truthfully. I fully endorse the course of action, as does the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. We have already discussed the option. The president thought for a second.
How soon will our carrier battle groups be on station?
Approximately 15 to 20 hours, sir, Kirchner answered. Aksenhoff, visibly irritated and looking disheveled, walked to a chair and sat down heavily.
May I ask what this is about? We agreed 9 o'clock this morning, did we not, Mr. President? I have something special to show you. Brian, please run the tape again.
Yes, sir, Gaines replied as he punched the VCR play button. Aksenhoff attempted to remain impassive as the commandeered stealth bomber appeared on the screen. The room remained quiet when the VCR clicked off. Aksenhoff turned slowly to the president.
What is the point of this film, Mr. President? I've seen pictures of your stealth bomber many times.
Jarrett looked Aksenhoff in the eyes.
My point, Mr. Aksenhoff, is that our missing B-2 bomber is sitting in a hangar at San Julian Air Force Base in Cuba, a satellite of the Soviet Union.
Aksenhoff, confused and knowing the futility of continuing the charade, let out a convincing sigh.
Mr. President, I have no knowledge of any operation involving your B-2 aircraft.
Well, Jarrett responded coldly, I strongly suggest that you contact your superiors in Moscow and find out who is responsible for the hijacking. We know that the individual who commandeered the B-2 has ties to the KGB. I believe you understand. We are on a collision course, Mr. Aksenhoff, and I urge you to intervene before we face off militarily.
Steve Wickham peeked out cautiously from an opening in the foundation of the administration building. The airbase was crawling with Cuban soldiers, all looking for the intruder. The dank, mildewed hiding place was a maze of spiderwebs and rotting wood supports. Wickham thought about his options, knowing that it would be daylight soon. He reasoned that the search would intensify once the sun topped the horizon. He had to think of a way to escape from sure death. He watched a car approach the building and stop next to a group of Cuban soldiers. A Soviet officer stepped out of the vehicle and walked to the cluster of men. Suddenly, the soldiers formed two groups and approached the barracks and administration building. Wickham swore to himself and scooted back 3 feet. He wedged the camera and the assault rifle between the cracked foundation and a support beam, then braced his toes on the concrete ledge. Placing his fingers through a rotted hole in the wooden beam, he braced himself up between the supports. He held his breath, listening to the men, as two of the soldiers looked under the building with flashlights. Seconds became an eternity as Wickham's arms began to quiver from the strain of holding his body horizontally. Finally, when the soldiers had finished their inspection, Wickham sagged to the ground and crawled next to the small opening in the foundation. He ventured a quick look outside, then retreated to a corner of the building. The soldiers had moved on to another structure, and the Soviet officer was driving away. Wickham considered his options as his pulse returned to normal. 5 minutes later, after analyzing his limited choices, the agent resigned himself to the only viable possibility. He would have to wait until nightfall to attempt an escape. 7 armed guards surrounded the partially dismantled stealth bomber. All activity had ceased in the hangar while everyone involved in the secret operation was interrogated by the KGB director. Abukov, the assistant KGB director, approached Levchenkov's door.
"Have you found the infiltrator?" Levchenkov barked. "Comrade director, our men are scouring the base and surrounding area. We have 3 helicopters and 2 spotter planes in the air, and we are..."
"Don't give me long-winded reports. Give me results. I want every inch of this base searched again."
Norman Lazar and his deputy, David Ridgefield, sat waiting to hear from Hampton Milligan in Key West. Both men glanced occasionally at the television monitor in the corner of Lazar's office.
"Well, General," Ridgefield said, "Wickham pulled it off." "Yes, he did, the crazy son of a bitch. I wish we had another 50 like him."
A special report flashed on the television monitor. "Dave, turn it up." Ridgefield pressed the volume button on the remote control next to his chair. The anchorman looked into the camera.
"Cuban President Fidel Castro moments ago issued a declaration of war aimed at the United States. Speaking from his home at Varadero Beach, Castro lashed out vehemently at President Jarrett and vowed to confront any military threat to Cuba. Castro has dispatched his brother, Army Commander Raul Castro, to personally take command of Cuban Army troops advancing toward the San Julian Air Base. San Julian is the purported location of the missing B-2 stealth bomber. White House sources have refused to comment."
The 40,500-ton amphibious assault ship steamed south toward the western tip of Cuba. Embarked on board the 844-foot ship were 1,966 Marines, supported by 18 AV, 8B Harrier 2 jets, 4 LAMPS-2 helicopters, and 4 CH-53E Marine Super Stallion helicopters. On the wall deck below the 2.2-acre flight deck, 3 air-cushioned landing craft waited to transport the Marine Expeditionary Force ashore near San Julian. The 4 helicopters, each carrying 55 Marines, would land at strategic points around San Julian Air Base. The LAMPS-3 helicopters, with their long-range air-to-surface radar and advanced data link, would manage the over-the-horizon assault. The 18 Marine AV-8B close support attack fighters would provide air cover for the Marine landing force. WASP's sister ship, USS Essex, followed the lead assault carrier at a distance of 70 nautical miles. Essex would land her assault force 3/4 of a mile north of WASP's unit. Both assault groups would go ashore at Bahia de Guadiana, then forge east to San Julian. Levchenko, seething and shouting commands, stormed into his office. He had been informed only minutes earlier that he had had a double agent in his midst, an agent who had relayed live pictures of the B-2 bomber to Washington. Levchenko, absorbed in ferreting out the spy, yanked his telephone across the desk and sat down heavily.
"Who the hell am I supposed to call?" he bellowed at the skinny clerk.
"A President Castro, comrade direct..."
"Bullshit!" Levchenko raged,
eyes bulging. Levchenko knew that he would face a firing squad if he could not isolate the traitor under his command. Now, with his life on the line, Fidel Castro was meddling in the stealth operation.
"I don't report to Castro," Levchenko continued, breathing heavily. "Who took the call?"
"I did, comrade director," the frightened man answered. "He said immediately, that's why the lieutenant chased after you, comrade director."
"Get out!"
The clerk hurried through the door. Levchenko placed the call.
"Levchenko."
Castro's voice was loud and abrupt.
"Have the American bomber ready to fly the time my brother arrives at San Julian."
Levchenko was stunned by the order.
"Comrade President, you cannot make such a demand." "Have the B-2 ready to fly," Castro ordered. "Raul is on the way to San Julian."
Levchenko sat staring into the hangar after Castro had terminated the conversation.
"Goddamned fanatic," Levchenko growled in disgust.
Levchenko's stomach churned as he considered his options. First, he had to contact KGB headquarters in Moscow. Levchenko walked out of the office and headed toward the communications center. the KGB director, developing a strategy to protect himself, entered the sophisticated message center. He walked to one of the two direct lines to KGB headquarters, dismissed the communications officer brusquely, then sat down and initiated the voice-scrambled call. The Soviet Foxtrot-class submarine, crewed by Cuban sailors and a KGB political officer, moved slowly through the depths of the Gulf of Mexico. 3.5 hours had passed since the General Alvarado Alvarez had submerged 180 kilometers northwest of Havana. The captain, Ricardo Esteban, had ascended to periscope depth twice during that time to receive messages informing him that President Castro had declared war on the United States. The General Alvarez carried 3 Soviet-manufactured anti-ship torpedoes. The devastating weapons, fired from the bow tubes, had the power to sink an aircraft carrier.
Captain, the sonar operator said in a loud whisper, I have a contact bearing 340, 2 propellers turning at high speed.
Esteban turned white, glancing nervously at the KGB officer.
Right, 20 degrees. The contact is big, the intent Cuban sonar man reported. Very big, Captain.
The political officer, openly irritated, stepped forward to the sonar station.
Range? What's the goddamn range?
20 kilometers, possibly less, comrade.
Stand by for forward tubes, the Soviet officer ordered, aggressively taking command. Come to periscope depth.
Esteban, openly embarrassed, shrugged his shoulders and retreated against the bulkhead. The control room talker, apprehension in his eyes, turned to the Soviet officer.
Forward tubes ready to fire, comrade.
The Russian commanded.
Give me bearing and distance at 1 minute intervals. 337.
18 kilometers, comrade. The tension in the control room mounted as the range of the contact closed.
Bearing 335, the sonar specialist said. 14 kilometers. Up periscope, the grim-faced Russian ordered.
The thin attack scope slid into position. The Russian grasped the periscope handles and swung the scope around the horizon, stopping on the large contact.
It's a carrier, an American troop carrier,
Esteban flinched inwardly. The Soviet officer scanned both sides of the big warship.
I hold 3 frigates and 1 destroyer. Down scope.
The officer turned to Esteban.
You will give the order to fire, comrade captain.
The amphibious assault carrier, steaming at 20 knots, was preparing to land a flight of 4 Marine AV-8B Harrier II jets. The 2 S-3B Viking anti-submarine warfare aircraft, supplemented by 3 LAMPS-3 ASW helicopters, orbited around the carrier at varying distances. WASP's CIC came to life when one of the LAMP's 3 ASW helicopters radioed a report.
Crossbow, Coldwater 3 has contact, the pilot said.
Roger, Coldwater 3, the CIC officer replied as he sounded general quarters.
Drop a marker and stand clear.
Hey, Roger, the pilot radioed, searching the water around and below the helicopter.
Coldwater 3 is marking, solid contact confirmed.
Less than 5 seconds passed before the ASW pilot shouted and pointed below. His co-pilot saw the periscope a second later.
We have a periscope. We have a scope below us, the CIC officer said.
Seawolf 712 cleared for a drop. Warning red. Weapons free.
Copy. Copy, the S-3B Viking pilot radioed. Tally on the smoke. We're coming downhill.
Captain Ricardo Esteban squinted through the attack periscope. The American assault carrier would be at the optimum torpedo attack position in less than half a minute.
Stand by to fire on my command, Esteban ordered,
tracking the carrier. He rotated the periscope quickly to check the horizon around the battle group, then stopped in panic when he saw the canister. It was 80 meters off the starboard bow, pumping out billowing clouds of bright yellow smoke.
Smoke, Esteban said. They're on us! Down scope!
Esteban ordered, backing away from the attack periscope as if it were a ghost.
Dive! Dive! Negative! Negative! Upscope!
The Russian officer grasped the periscope handles firmly and made a slight adjustment.
Fire one!
The tense, sweating KGB officer ordered, then looked at the firing board lights. The bright green launch light winked on. The General Alvarez shuddered as the powerful torpedo shot out of the flooded tube.
Fire a tube! The Russian barked. Down scope, dive, dive, full right rudder, all ahead flank.
The Soviet officer shot Esteban a contemptuous glance.
Rig for depth charges.
We've got torpedoes,
the pilot broadcast as he prepared to drop two depth charges. Two targets tracking WASP. Roger, the aircraft commander replied. We're falling in now. One is off, clearing port. Two has a tally, the second Viking pilot responded. He was a split second from his release point when the first two depth charges exploded, sending two huge geysers gushing out of the water. Two's off, the second Viking pilot radioed, then snapped into a climbing left turn. One's in! The 40,500-ton carrier was slowing steadily. A senior chief petty officer ran down the length of the flight deck waving his arms, yelling for everyone to hit the deck. The first torpedo, traveling at 23 knots, rammed the carrier and detonated in a blinding white flash. The underwater blast ripped off the bottom third of the WASP's bow. The second Russian torpedo hit the starboard side 40 yards aft of the initial impact. The explosion sent another blast and shockwave over the flight deck. The effects of the attack were devastating. WASP plowed to a stop with two gaping holes in her bow. The scene on the flight deck was chaotic. The huge ship was taking on water rapidly. Debris rained down on the heavily damaged carrier as water surged through her forward compartments. A group of sailors working on the lowered flight deck elevator had been blown overboard by the second explosion. WASP's escort ships moved closer to the stricken carrier while both Viking anti-submarine jets continued to track the submarine. The Viking crews, enraged by the unexpected blasts, were determined to sink the enemy's sub. "We have to surface," Captain Esteban shouted as water sprayed from two overhead pipes. "Niet," the officer shot back, nervously watching the water rise above his ankles. "We can't surface. They're on top of us." The sailors, fear showing in their eyes, were desperately trying to contain the leaks caused by the pressure surges from the depth charges. "Torpedo room reports heavy flooding," the frightened control room talker reported to Esteban. They want out, Captain." "Negative," the Russian ordered. Esteban paused, looking at the depth gauge, then faced the sullen Russian. "We have to take pressure off the hull before something fails." "We will remain at this depth," the Soviet officer commanded angrily, "until we are clear of the area." "Captain," the sailor manning the diving plane said in a panic-choked voice, "I can't control. The bow is going down." Esteban stared at the diving plane indicator. The controls were in the full up position, and the depth was increasing. The stricken submarine was beginning to plunge toward the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. "Blow forward tanks," Esteban ordered, ignoring the Russian. "All ahead, two-thirds." "I am in command," the officer shouted. "I will decide when we sit." His statement was cut off when a weld joint on the side of the inner hull split, spraying cold water into the control room. The high-pressure discharge was like a stream from a fire hose. "Surface! Emergency surface!" Esteban shouted above the confusion. "Blow all tanks!" A rumbling noise reverberated through the submarine as the lights flickered twice and went out. "Emergency power! Give me emergency lights! We're sinking!" the diving plane operator cried. "Oh, mother of God, we're..." "Shut up!" the Russian bellowed. "All full ahead! Blow tanks! Blow tanks!" The crew was hysterical in the dark, sinking submarine. The hull creaked loudly, then ripped open in a terrifying screech, sending tons of seawater crashing into the control room. Levchenko walked out of the communication center and headed for his office. He had ordered his deputy to return to the hangar immediately. Levchenko had major problems to solve and needed the assistance of Obukhov. The KGB director walked into his office and sat down, seething.
"Sit down," Levchenko ordered. "We have big problems. This operation is disintegrating and now Castro is interfering. He called me in. He ordered me to have the stealth ready to fly when his brother arrives."
"What is he doing?"
"Castro has declared war on the United States."
"War?"
Obukhov responded. "Castro has declared war? Why?" "He believes that the Americans are preparing to invade Cuba to retrieve their bomber. I have contacted Moscow and our goddamn director, the hot-headed idiot who didn't want extra security here, who wanted the base to look like every other base so the satellite photos wouldn't show any changes, ordered me to protect the bomber. Golodnikov said that the B-2 must be secured at any cost. Our orders are to keep Castro's people away from the B-2 until Golodnikov decides what action to take."
"What about the bomber? Are you going to prepare it for flight?"
"Yeah,"
Levchenko answered. It may eliminate the military conflict with the United States. When is Raoul scheduled to arrive? I don't know. Who knows what those lunatics will do next? I am going to need your help to salvage what we can of this goddamn mess. President Alton Jarrett rushed down the long corridor to the Situation Room. What happened, Bernie? The president asked. A.J., Kirchner replied. The Wasp has been torpedoed, and we have sustained heavy casualties. The president's face turned ashen. Jesus Christ. Well, what happened to our air cover? I don't know, Mr. President. The submarine was apparently detected at the same time the torpedoes were fired. Did they get the sub? They aren't sure, sir, but we'll have to wait for a detailed report. Heavy casualties, the chief of state asked. That is the report, sir. The surface escorts reported men in the water. The president's jaw was set rigid. I want Castro's military installations reduced to rubble. All of them. Every goddamn airfield, port, ship, airplane, radar site, everything destroyed. I want to keep this military, understand, Bernie? No cities or civilians, just military targets. Yes, sir. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, Secretary of Defense, and Director of the CIA stood when the President entered the room, followed by the Vice President, Secretary of State, and National Security Advisor. Be seated, gentlemen, Jarrett said. As you know, the skipper of the Wasp has confirmed 61 casualties, with 4 sailors and 1 Marine missing. Secretary Kirchner has just received a report confirming that the submarine has sunk. The flotsam, along with the bodies that surfaced, indicate clearly that the submarine was operated by the Cubans. I will not tolerate a long, protracted operation. We have to ensure that we use the correct weapons, and enough of them, to accomplish the objective in 1 or 2 strikes. And we have telegraphed our intentions to Castro, as you well know, so our strike will have to be a maximum effort. I will contact President Ignatyev minutes before the first strike aircraft reach the targets. The Soviets will be on notice not to interfere on behalf of their nationals. And if they do become involved, which is a grave possibility, we will not hesitate to destroy them. The president glanced around the polished mahogany table. We will go on global alert 5 minutes before our first attack aircraft reach Cuban soil. Jarrett replaced his glasses. Are there any questions, gentlemen? The National Security Advisor cleared his throat. Mr. President, what is your feeling about the B-2? Do you intend to destroy the aircraft or retrieve it? Brian, the president replied, we are about to engage Cuba militarily. At this point, we don't have the luxury of recovering a B-2 intact. San Julian was bustling with activity as additional weapons were placed in strategic locations. 4 squads of Cuban soldiers rushed from site to site, camouflaging the armament. Portable surface-to-air missiles ringed the airbase along with radar-controlled anti-aircraft guns. 7 MiG-23s, 8 MiG-25 Foxbats, and 12 MiG-29 Fulcrums had been fueled and loaded with ordnance in preparation for the expected American assault. The fighters were lined up on the runway and taxiway, ready to be airborne in 5 minutes. Levchenko sat on the small bunk in the cramped quarters behind his officer. The chief communications officer rapped on the edge of his open door. Comrade Director, the man said cautiously, I have an urgent message for you. Moscow called? What is it? The communications officer swallowed. Raul Castro is en route to our base, Comrade Director. God damn it! Get Moscow on the line! I want answers! The flustered officer hurried out of the small office and ran toward the communications center. Levchenko hastily slipped on his boots and marched into the hangar. He surveyed the B-2, noting it was in the final stages of reassembly. Levchenko walked over to the senior airframe technician. When will the stealth be ready to fly? 2.5, possibly 3 hours at most, Comrade Director. Levchenko looked at his watch, thoroughly disgruntled with the change of events. A damn sure better be, he growled, then spun around and headed for the communications center. He was about to enter the communications room when the harried comm officer rushed out. Comrade Director, Moscow is on the line, and Castro's helicopter just landed at operation base.
Son of a bitch,
Levchenko yelped. He stormed into the room and yanked up the receiver next to the blinking yellow light.
Levchenko!
The KGB director was paralyzed momentarily when he heard the voice of the discreet phone. Not a subordinate, division chief, or operations director. It was the director of the KGB.
Yeah, Comrade Director.
He listened intently to Vladimir Golodnikov, motioning for the communications officer to close the door, then scribbled a note to the surprised man.
Yeah, I understand, Comrade Director,
Levchenko said as the comm officer read the scrawl and rushed out to find Obukhov.
Ya, Comrade Director,
Levchenko continued, surprised by the order he had been given.
I will keep you informed, Comrade Director.
Levchenko listened to the final statement, then said goodbye. He and Obukhov arrived at Levchenko's office at the same time.
We have more problems. Raul Castro is here.
I was informed, Obukhov responded. Levchenko sat down at his desk.
I just had a conversation with our stubborn director, the man. He ordered us to cooperate with Castro. They are backing off, washing their hands of the operation now that we have the goddamn airplane. I'm not sure I understand, Comrade Director. Goddamn it! The situation is out of control. Golodnikov knows the operation has collapsed. They can't contain or control Castro, and they have turned their backs on the operation and us. The Kremlin is not to be involved further. The stealth bomber belongs to Castro as of now.
Levchenko noticed a commotion in the hangar. He stood, then walked to the door and opened it.
He's here.
Levchenko and Obukhov silently observed Raul Castro in a small procession enter the hangar, stop for a moment to take in the secret bomber, then walk slowly toward the workspaces and office. Raul Castro gave Levchenko an obligatory handshake.
You do not have the bomber ready to fly, Castro accused.
Comrade General,
the bomber will be ready to fly in 3 hours. The men are working as fast as they can.
Raul Castro leaned into Levchenko's face.
I will be back in 3 hours. Have it ready.
Yes, Comrade General. Levchenko supervised the final assembly of the stealth bomber. Levchenko had watched the time closely, expecting the Cuban general to return at the end of 3 hours. He observed the tire technicians replace the last access panel, then went into the lavatory and was washing his face with cold water when Obukhov rushed in.
Comrade Director, Obukhov said breathlessly. Raul Castro called. He wants an engine run-up on the stealth and then have it towed to the flight line.
Levchenko looked at his assistant through tired, bloodshot eyes.
What are you waiting for? It's his airplane now. We're out of the picture. Ah, Comrade Director, I will take care of everything.
Levchenko was about to lie down when the sergeant from the communications room appeared at the door.
Comrade Director, you have an urgent call from Moscow.
Steve Wickham, hearing the loud sound of jet engines being started, inched next to the opening in the foundation. The base was completely blacked out except for a group of men working with flashlights. He studied the soldiers, unsure of what they were trying to accomplish. The men worked rapidly, moving rocks and fence posts. Wickham continued to observe the group after they had passed his position. 3 minutes later, the jet engines reached a howling crescendo, then throttled down and shut off. After the soldiers had completed their task, Wickham grabbed the assault rifle and ventured out of the small hole. He remained on his stomach and looked cautiously around the immediate area. Wickham listened intently for any sign of soldiers, then crawled to the corner of the building. He edged around the side and froze when he saw the B-2. He watched the bomber as it was towed down the cleared path. Then he crawled back to the opening in the foundation and returned to his place of concealment. If they were going to fly the B-2 out of Cuba, Wickham reasoned, the roar during takeoff would help cover his escape. Levchenko replaced the phone receiver, shook his head, and turned to the watch officer. "Get Telavokine up," Levchenko ordered, "and have General Borskarnov report to me immediately." Telavokine, groggy and disheveled, walked into the offices. "Sit down, Telavokine." "Yeah, Comrade Director," the security chief responded. Levchenko noticed Obukhov at the door. He motioned him in. "Headquarters has decreed a change in plans in regard to the bomber." Telavokine and Obukhov glanced at each other with apprehension, but remained silent as General Borskarnov, irritation written on his face, walked through the door. "Have a seat, General. We have received new orders. We, more to the point, you, General, are going to be responsible for flying the bomber out of Cuba." The three men looked at Levchenko with equal amazement. Borskarnov leaned forward. "What am I?" Levchenko interrupted. "We have much to accomplish in a short span of time. First, this change of plans originated at the highest level of KGB, and word is being sent to Fidel Castro as we speak. Castro is screaming about getting the bomber off his island immediately. He and Raul are convinced that the Americans are going to invade Cuba to get the stealth bomber back. So, Moscow has decided to fly it to the Soviet Union." Levchenko looked directly at Telavokine. "Also, our director is outraged over the breach of security here. The pictures that were relayed to the Americans. You, Telavokine, are going to sequester every single person involved in this project until I give you further orders." "Yeah, Comrade Director." "You will gather everyone in the middle of the hangar, everyone, until I give you the word." Obukhov turned pale. "Now, I will explain our orders. General Borskarnov, along with the American pilot and defector, Simmons, are going to fly the bomber to Russia. Your orders are to fly straight west over Mexico and the Pacific Ocean to a point 1,200 miles east of Hawaii. From there, you will turn northwest and land at Yelizovo, or Kamchatka Peninsula. Get Simmons in here, then take four guards and bring the pilot to my office." "Yeah, Comrade Director." As Telavokine hurried out the door, Levchenko turned to Borskarnov. "You will take off as soon as the bomber is fueled. Moscow wants you airborne as quickly as possible to take advantage of the dark. You will not be exposed to daylight until you are northeast of the Hawaiian Islands. They are confident that you will not be detected." "Oh, what are they thinking about in Moscow? This is crazy. If we get caught, it will jeopardize all the gains we have made." "God damn it! I am not going to argue with you. The orders originated from the director of the KGB. You either comply or contact Golodnikov." Borskarnov sat mute. The KGB officer turned to Larry Simmons when he appeared at the door. "Come in and have a seat, Comrade Simmons." Borskarnov shook his head. "We're digging ourselves a deeper hole, Comrade Director. We do not question our orders." Steve Wickham peeked out from the opening in the foundation of the administration building. The agent had been surprised by the escalating activity around the perimeter of the airbase. The Cubans were amassing a tremendous amount of anti-aircraft weapons. Wickham leaned back. His best chance for escape was now. He watched a field car, followed by two motorized anti-aircraft guns, approach the building from the path the B-2 had traveled. Wickham slid the assault rifle behind him and quickly eased out from under his hiding place. Chuck Matthews, accompanied by Telavokine and the Cuban guards, walked unsteadily into Levchenko's office. "Sit down," the KGB director ordered briskly. "You are going to fly your bomber again to the Soviet Union." Matthews was stupefied. "Take him to the van," Levchenko ordered as he turned his attention to Borskarnov. "We'll be there in a minute." Steve Wickham stepped in front of the car and raised his right arm. The Cuban driver mashed the brake pedal as Wickham hurried to the vehicle. Wickham recognized the Soviet officer in the passenger seat. The agent, thinking rapidly, approached the door and spoke to the officer in fluent Russian. "Capitan, I am Yuri Kuyev, KGB Special Operations." The Soviet officer, taken unaware, looked at Wickham with suspicion. Wickham continued quickly, seeing the doubt on the officer's face. We have another serious breach in base security. Take me to the director of the KGB. We do not have a second to waste. Yes, comrade, the captain replied. Wickham, speaking in Spanish, motioned to the Cuban soldier behind the wheel. Out, get out. The Cuban jumped out of the field car as the officer quickly switched seats. Hurry, Wickham ordered, leaping into the vacated passenger seat. The American bomber is in jeopardy. The Soviet officer floored the vehicle. Stop at the first hangar, comrade Capitan, the B-2 hangar. The Russian glanced at Wickham suspiciously. The director's office is in the B-2 hangar. Wickham saw the officer's hand flash towards his leather holster. The van weaved between the control tower and a fuel tank, stopping 20 meters from the stealth bomber. A second fuel truck was pumping jet fuel into Shadow 37. Matthews scrutinized the B-2. The pilot could tell they were filling the fuel tanks to capacity. He also noticed the increased activity around the airfield, along with the vast number of anti-aircraft batteries that had been installed. The van came to a stop near the entrance to an underground bomb shelter. Levchenko opened his door. General Brodskarnov, check the aircraft carefully. Brodskarnov hesitated. I don't even have a flight suit. There isn't time. Moscow wants you in the air immediately. The general walked to the aircraft. Levchenko stepped in front of Matthews. If you try one thing, anything, to hinder us, I will have you shot on the spot. Levchenko turned to Simmons. If he tries anything in the air, you are ordered to shoot him. General Brodskarnov can fly the plane once it is airborne. Simmons nodded quietly, accepted the weapon, then walked to the bomber and released the crew entrance hatch. Steve Wickham backhanded the Soviet officer viciously in the larynx, then slammed his head into the steering wheel. The blow stunned the captain. The agent shoved the inert officer against his door, releasing the handle. Wickham balled his fists tightly, then slammed them into the captain's temples. The bone-crushing blow sent the Russian headfirst into the ground. The agent flicked off the dim lights and pressed firmly on the gas pedal. Puffs of dirt flew up beside the speeding car as Wickham approached the perimeter fence. Chuck Matthews, startled by the gunfire, felt a nudge in his lower back. Get down, a Cuban guard ordered. On your stomach. Matthews dropped to his knees, then rolled on his right shoulder and spread out. He could hear more shots being fired from the far end of the airfield. Levchenko, followed by Raul Castro and two senior Cuban officers, ran up the stairs and out the underground command post. Castro turned to his officers. Secure the perimeter and get the gunships airborne. Gesturing wildly, he turned to Levchenko. Take off. Get the bomber out of here. Untie the pilot, Levchenko shouted to the guards. Get him in the plane. A split second later, the command radio crackled again. Someone had seized the field car and was about to crash through the fence. Raul Castro barked over the radio. Stop the car! An automatic weapon opened fire, causing Steve Wickham to swerve. He straightened the vehicle and braced himself for a collision with the barbed wire fence. Mashing the accelerator with all his strength, Wickham aimed the field car between two support posts, sending the barbed wire strand snapping over his head. Wickham, now straddling the middle of the road, looked back towards the airfield and spotted two Soviet helicopter gunships closing rapidly on him. He concentrated on his driving, glancing back often. The fourth time Wickham looked, both helicopters appeared to twinkle. A millisecond later, the ground erupted in a shower of flying dirt and debris. Wickham wrenched the wheel hard to the left, then rocketed into the deep jungle foliage. The field car smashed through the thick entanglement and ground to an abrupt halt. The agent leaped out of his seat and grasped the overhead-mounted machine gun. One of the Mi-24 gunships pulled up for another firing pass as the second helicopter orbited to call the firing runs. The gunship pilot hurtled toward the field car. The Mi-24's turret gunner commenced firing, sending a stream of high-velocity shells into the ground 12 meters in front of the vehicle. Wickham pointed the machine gun at the first helicopter. He squeezed the trigger, holding it tightly until the gun jammed. Wickham leaped to the ground and ran through the thick jungle for 150 meters, then stopped and changed direction. He knew he had to hurry to reach the beach where he had come ashore. The OV-10 extraction was his only hope of avoiding a firing squad. "Move it!" Levchenko shouted as Matthews climbed into the dark cockpit to join Simmons. Major General Brotskarnov, after his quick walk around the B-2, climbed into the bomber and sat down in the co-pilot's seat. He busied himself, strapping in as Simmons locked the crew entrance hatch, twisted around, then sat down in the third seat. "You have checklist?" Brotskarnov asked, glancing at his side panel. "The checklist will come up on the screen over the center console when we have power," Matthews replied. The general looked at the dark screen, then said, "I do not read English so good." "I'll take care of it," Matthews responded. The American pilot looked over his shoulder. Larry Simmons, holding a flashlight, had Levchenko's revolver drawn. Steve Wickham, short of breath, dropped to the ground. He rested on his stomach as he looked around cautiously. The agent had heard the voices of soldiers walking down the road. He crawled forward to get a better view of the activity on the road. The long line of men stretched around a curve on the same dirt road the agent had traversed going to San Julian. Another sound caught the agent's attention. He could hear the subdued conversation of a group of soldiers making their way along the path the American had just traveled. Wickham swore to himself. The agent was caught between the column of troops on the road and the search party advancing on his position. Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Matthews taxied the bomber toward the runway. Matthews pointed the nose into the easterly wind towards Ensenada de Cortez, checked the engine instruments a third time, then glanced at Brotskarnov and Simmons. "Ready?" Matthews asked as he held the brakes and walked the throttles forward. Simmons fastened his helmet tighter, nodded yes. Brotskarnov, unsure what his flying responsibilities would entail, looked at the American pilot. "You will tell me what to do." Matthews simultaneously released the brakes and shoved the four throttles forward. "Just sit tight and don't touch anything until I tell you." Simmons listened to the pilots over the intercom, held his revolver on his thigh. Shadow 37, heavily laden with fuel, gathered speed slowly as the four turbofans split the air with a deafening roar. The bomber accelerated in ground effect through 230 knots before the pilots started to climb. Wickham glanced around quickly, then crawled 3 meters to an area of dense foliage. His ability to hear the approaching soldiers was nullified temporarily during the B-2's takeoff. Now, as the thundering bomber clipped away, Wickham could clearly hear the approaching search party. The agent worked at camouflaging himself in the foliage, pulling leaves over his body. Wickham lay perfectly still, his heart racing wildly as the soldiers advanced on the clump of vegetation. Wickham's eyes locked in one position, looked out from a small opening. He could see three Cubans, wielding machetes, moving steadily towards his concealment. Six additional soldiers followed close behind, their assault rifles at the ready. The seconds turned into minutes for the agent as the search party reached his chancy hiding place. Two soldiers, with flashlights, walked within 2 meters of Wickham's head, paused, looked left and right, then continued toward the road. 4 minutes passed before Wickham ventured a move. He raised his head slightly and peered through the camouflage. The soldiers had moved out of view of his position. He sat up cautiously, then quietly rolled over onto his stomach. A gunship flew slowly overhead. Wickham decided to retrace his trail and conceal himself until the search party moved down the road. Remaining on his stomach, he began backing away. He felt a searing pain when the back of his head collided with a sharp, solid object. The agent stopped, then turned his head slowly. He froze in stark terror as he stared at the barrel of an AK-47 assault rifle. Matthews watched the shoreline pass under the B-2's nose, checked his airspeed and rate of climb, then rolled into a gentle left turn. After reversing course, he engaged the autopilot and reprogrammed the first navigational waypoint.
Major General Brotskarnov watched Matthews closely as he remained silent as the aircraft climbed through 7,000 feet. We'll level at 36,000, Matthews announced over the intercom. We'll stay between cardinal altitudes to avoid traffic. Matthews looked at the instrument panel. The clock read 4:02 a.m. The lone Cuban soldier, holding his cap in the helicopter downwash, stepped back and motioned with his rifle for Wickham to stand. The fat, sweat-soaked man had been a straggler who had fallen behind his patrol. Wickham raised to one knee, caught the Cuban looking ahead for his unit, then leaped at the soldier like a sprinter out of the starting blocks. The agent hit the obese man square in the chest at the same time the soldier pulled the trigger. The round blasted through the trees, sounding an alarm. The Cuban, gasping for breath, dropped his rifle and fell to the ground with a thud. Wickham scooped up the rifle and slammed the butt into the soldier's head, knocking him unconscious. Wickham turned and raced through the heavy foliage. He stopped abruptly at the edge of the clearing. He could see that Cuban troops had him surrounded. There was no way out except across the open field. He cursed the bright Caribbean moonlight as he crashed through the thick growth, then sprinted across the field. Shots rang out, kicking up sprays of dirt as the American zigzagged in a low crouch. Wickham reached the far side of the clearing at the same instant a high-velocity round slammed into his right boot. The impact knocked Wickham's leg out from under him, sending the agent sprawling to the ground. Over the Yucatan Channel, Marine Captain Greg Spidell checked the time. Aware that Wickham had transmitted pictures of the B-2, Spidell was prepared to extract the agent at any point prior to 5 a.m. He flew the OV-10 Bronco in a lazy circle with the Garrett turboprops throttled back to conserve fuel. Spidell, talking occasionally with his winch operator, waited impatiently for the signal from the CIA agent. The extraction call would have to come soon if he was going to complete the mission this morning. Wickham rolled over and sat up. He pulled his tingling leg and looked at his right boot. The thick heel had been partially blown off, but the round had not hit his foot. He jumped to his feet, raced into the jungle, then turned toward the road, determined to get across and head for the beach. Wickham watched a large patrol, rifles at the ready, walking cautiously down the road. The sound of the search party behind him forced a bold decision. Seeing a Russian staff sergeant at the head of the Cuban column, Wickham ran out in the road. Wickham said in Russian, "I am Kapitan Kuyev, KGB. Get your men and cover that field. We have a foreign agent trapped somewhere in the middle." "Ja, Comrade Kapitan," the sergeant replied, turning to his patrol. "Move out!" Wickham watched the soldiers hurry back along the road, then turned and sprinted for his life. He slowed momentarily, checked behind him, and ran into a tobacco field. The agent yanked out his small watch. He had less than 45 minutes to make the extraction deadline. Walking rapidly, he replaced the timepiece and pulled out the satellite transmitter. It was time to send Spidell the extraction signal. Greg Spidell was startled when the high-pitched beep-beep sounded in his earphones. "Here we go," he announced, pushing the throttles and stick forward simultaneously. "We're going to be tight on time and fuel." The OV-10 Bronco, flying more than 300 miles per hour, descended to 150 feet over the peninsula and raced for the extraction coordinates. 10 minutes later, Spidell reduced power and eased down to 100 feet. He would be on station in 15 minutes. Steve Wickham, breathing heavily, jogged at a steady pace past the weathered houses he had seen en route to San Julian. The agent left the dirt road, splashing noisily across the shallow marsh he had waded through going to the airfield. Wickham could hear gunships spreading out to the south and west of San Julian. He also saw the glowing afterburners of the two MiG-29s as they climbed out of the airfield. Checking the time on the run, the agent realized that he was not going to make the beach by the 0500 deadline. He had only 8 minutes to traverse the final half mile to the rescue point. He slowed, yanked out the satellite transmitter, and punched in the extraction code again. He pointed the minuscule antenna over his head and squeezed the send button. Greg Spidell had just entered his first orbit in the OV-10 when he heard Steve Wickham's signal again. He scanned the sky frantically, looking for the bright Silum light stick. The gunnery sergeant had also heard the second extraction signal. "Skipper, you figure he's ready for the statch?" "I don't know, Gunny,"
Spidell answered. We don't have a visual. Check behind us while I set up for another pass. Copy. 15 seconds passed while the OV-10 completed the course change. Skipper, I can't see jack shit. Spidell set his radio altimeter for 75 feet of altitude. Okay, we'll make 2 more orbits, then I'm going to make a pass down the coast. We got the gas, Captain? Spidell hesitated, making a quick calculation. We're standing on the wire now. The blacked-out bomber, now 390 miles east of Tampico, Mexico, cruised at 36,000 feet in calm air. Shadow 37 remained in total darkness, racing the morning light westward. Chuck Matthews punched in the latitude and longitude of their next waypoint. The B-2 would pass 28 miles south of Cabo San Lucas before turning northwest to Russia. General Brotskarnov continued to study the sophisticated cockpit as he watched Matthews. Larry Simmons remained quiet, fingering his revolver constantly. Unknown to Matthews, Shadow 37 had passed within 12 miles of two F-14s from the USS Kitty Hawk. The radar screens in the combat air patrol fighters had remained blank as the bomber crossed the Gulf in front of the Tomcats. Steve Wickham, noticing the first hint of daylight, stumbled onto the beach. He fell forward, landing on his hands and knees. His breathing was slowing when he heard the OV-10 in the distance. Oh, shit, Wickham muttered, lurching to his feet. He ran through the salt grass, crossed a pair of sand dunes, and plopped down at the edge of a large guava thicket. The thick foliage concealed the wetsuit, skyhook harness, and water tow vehicle he had hidden there earlier. Abandoning the wetsuit, Wickham tore at the harness as the OV-10 made a pass down the beach. The aircraft, barely discernible in the faint light, appeared to be a mile offshore. Greg Spidell banked the OV-10 into a tight right turn and raced out to sea. He checked the fuel again and pressed the intercom. Gunny, I'm going to make 1 more pass. Captain, the sergeant replied, we ain't got the fuel. Spidell, ignoring the remark, flew a wide arc to start the second pass. He was not going to leave the CIA agent stranded. Wickham snapped the last ring on his harness, grabbed the water tow, scooped up his swim fins, and ran down the beach. He plunged into the water, slipped on the fins, and pressed the trigger on the water tow. After quickly negotiating the narrow gap in the coral reef, he relaxed his legs and let the water tow propel him out of the cove. 2 minutes later, Wickham again heard the OV-10. He released the water tow, snapped the silenum light stick, and popped the cylinder of compressed helium. The balloon inflated rapidly, dragging the elastic cord and chemical light stick to 200 feet. Wickham kicked off his swim fins, rolled on his back, and searched frantically for the approaching Bronco. Come on, he sputtered as he saw the eerie-looking light. I've got him, Spidell said over the intercom. I've got a visual on the light. He checked his altitude at 75 feet and slowed to 100 knots. Stand by. Spidell banked slightly to line up on his target. Watching the glowing light approach the center of his canopy sight ring, the pilot eased in a touch of right rudder and waited for the impact. 4 seconds later, the nose-mounted steel fork slammed into the elastic cord. Spidell shoved the throttles forward. Wickham, gasping for air, accelerated through the water, then popped into the air. During a moment of stability, he caught a glimpse of the light stick floating skyward at the end of the balloon. 6 miles to the east, the pilot of the MI-24 gunship also saw the strange glowing light. Greg Spidell climbed at a reduced airspeed of 120 knots. Wickham, dangling 25 feet behind and below the Bronco, watched the MI-24 helicopter pass by the ascending light stick and turn directly toward the OV-10. He knew that the gunship pilot could see the low-flying turboprop in the pale morning light. 30 seconds later, Wickham was in the grasp of the winch operator. After he pulled inside the aircraft, Wickham leaned next to the sergeant. We've got a gunship closing on us, Wickham shouted. The startled sergeant looked at the helicopter, then turned to Wickham. Strap in! Wickham scrambled forward and locked himself into a crew seat. The winch operator severed the elastic cord, crawled into his seat, secured his restraints, and keyed his intercom. Captain, our man's aboard and we've got a shooter. Gunship closing from 5 o'clock. How far out? I can't see him now. He's coming up on your right side. Are you both strapped in tight? That's a firm, the sergeant responded, bracing himself. Wickham, taking his cues from the gunnery sergeant, grabbed the handholds over his head. Hang tight, Spidell ordered as he flipped on his master arm and wheeled the accelerating Bronco into a tight wing over. Coming down the inside of the face-sagging turn, Spidell saw a flash of flame and smoke erupt from the gunship. The pilot, recognizing the launch of an air-to-air missile, fired both of his sidewinders and shoved the nose down violently. Passing 250 feet above the water, Spidell whipped the OV-10 into a steep turn. Spidell yanked the left throttle back and initiated an emergency shutdown to contain the fuel and hydraulic systems. Wickham, looking out the back, caught a glimpse of the Mi-24 as one of the sidewinders hit it head-on. The gunship shed the main rotor blades and plummeted into the water. The agent grabbed the spare headset and clamped it over his ears. He heard Spidell in mid-sentence talking to the sergeant.
"Lost the left engine, but we're okay for the moment."
Wickham keyed his intercom. "The gunship went in." Spidell recognized Wickham's voice.
"Yeah, I saw the impact flash. You okay?"
"Fine," Wickham replied.
"We gonna make it?"
Spidell hesitated before answering.
"We're a little tight on fuel. We may have to ditch off the Yucatan coast."
"Well, are you in contact with Cancun?" Wickham asked.
"I can be," the pilot answered.
"What's up?"
"The B-2 took off about 4 this morning."
"You saw it?" Spidell asked.
"No, but I heard it."
"Okay," said the pilot, switching on his scrambler. "You can talk by pushing the radio button on the cord. Let me check in and... we've lost our comm. Probably knocked the antennas off when the engine shelled."
"Do you have any other means of communication?"
"Afraid not," Spidell replied. "We'll have to wait until we land." Raul Castro, enraged and shouting orders to everyone in sight, heard the anti-aircraft guns start firing. He dashed to the control tower windows and shook his fist at the A-6Fs and the Hornets approaching the airfield. The Cuban general watched, stunned, as the strike aircraft leveled a dozen radar-controlled guns. The second wave of attack aircraft boomed across the field, dropping huge loads of bombs on the flight line, runway, and hangars. The windows blew in, knocking Castro to the floor. He picked himself up, partially blinded by the dust and debris, and grabbed his command phone. An F-14 blasted down the length of Ciudad Libertad, spraying 20-millimeter shells into parked aircraft, hangars, and a large fuel storage area. The fuel farm exploded, sending billowing black smoke and orange flames into the early morning sky. Castro, warned of the rapidly approaching bombers by Cuban and Soviet warships, sought refuge in the bomb shelter at the base of the control tower. The damp, musty-smelling shelter was full of personnel seeking cover from the air raids. Levchenko had dropped to the floor and covered his head when the anti-aircraft weapons commenced firing. The bombers screeched toward San Julian with an ear-shattering, high-pitched screech. Clouds of churning dust, smoke, and debris shot into the air as the deadly cluster of bombs pounded the airbase. The hail of anti-aircraft fire followed the fleeing planes, damaging two of the strategic bombers. Overhead, the B-1B's fighter escorts fired missiles at the MiGs, then chased after the surviving bombers. The stagnant air in the bomb shelter was thick with suffocating dust. Raul Castro, boiling with anger, stormed up the steps and kicked open the dented door. He was unprepared for the magnitude of destruction that lay around him. The hangars and support facilities, burning furiously, had been reduced to rubble. The control tower had toppled to the ground, crushing the Cuban general's personal helicopter. Raul also noticed that the baseball stadium had been destroyed. The walls of the underground hangar had caved in, touching off a fuel tank fire. The contingent of Cuban and Russian military personnel, including Levchenko, emerged from the underground shelter. Levchenko, seeing the blazing fire, knew that the intense heat had melted the tapes containing the secret stealth information. The Cuban general, shaking with rage, lunged towards Levchenko.
"The Soviet Union is responsible for this."
Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Matthews, growing more weary by the minute, prepared to alter course toward the Soviet airfield on Kamchatka Peninsula. Matthews, noticing the Russian general was beginning to show the effects of fatigue, glanced back at Simmons. The technician's eyes were wide open, and he sat up straight in his seat, still vigilant and cautious. Matthews, knowing that daylight would catch them in approximately 3 hours, had to figure a way to stop the flight. A haggard President Jarrett sat alone in his office, listening to his defense secretary on a secure line. The Vice President at Raven Rock and the Secretary of State at Mount Weather were also listening. The Joint Chiefs of Staff were monitoring the conversation.
God damn it, Bernie, the President said, hunched over his desk. I want containment, saturation bombing until Castro is completely neutralized. What is Ignatieff's position?
Mr. President, Gardner answered from Mount Weather, the Kremlin is pursuing an investigation of KGB officials, but they are flatly refuting any involvement. President Ignatieff contends that our pilots defected to Cuba and that Castro is operating on his own. Sir, Ignatieff has completely absolved the Soviet Union from any responsibility to the B-2 affair. The Secretary of Defense was listening to Sam Gardner when a CIA line buzzed. He switched off the speakerphone and picked up the receiver. Kirchner, Norm Lashar, the director said, sounding out of breath. We're just ahead of our operative from San Julian. Oh, just a second, Norm, Kirchner interrupted. The president is on the line. I'll put you through. Kirchner punched the conference call button and waited for a pause. Mr. President, Norm Lashar is on the line with an update from our San Julian operative.
We'll go ahead, Norm.
Sir, we have recovered our agent, Lashar said. They crash-landed off the coast near Cancun, out of gas, but they're okay. The agent confirms that the B-2 departed San Julian around 4 o'clock this morning. He couldn't tell the direction of the flight, but he's positive it took off.
Okay, Jarrett responded. Stay on the line,
the president addressed the entire group.
Gentlemen, we've got an entirely different situation now. Bernie, let's concentrate on finding the B-2. Do you have any idea where it might be at the present time?
Kirchner had been calculating the possibilities, but kept coming back to one point.
Sir, my bet is that they're flying away from the sun to stay in the dark as long as possible.
Mr. President, the Vice President said, my guess is they're traveling west or northwest, the quickest way to another hiding place with the least exposure to daylight.
Bernie, the B-2 has been airborne about 3.5 hours. That has to put them out somewhere around 1,700 to 1,800 miles.
Yes, sir, Kirchner replied.
Okay, let's move. Bernie, get every aircraft we can muster airborne. We have to have a semicircle of airplanes from the mid-Atlantic across North America to the western Pacific, beginning at a radius of 2,000 miles from San Julian. I want layers of aircraft all the way to the territorial limits of the Soviet Union. Sam, you notify the Kremlin, just in case, and make our position crystal clear.
Yes, sir, Gardner answered.
Bernie, the president said, the only way we're going to find the B-2 is to spot it visually in the daylight.
Well, you're right, sir, Kirchner responded, then added a question.
What action do you want to take when we locate the B-2?
Jarrett responded without hesitation.
If the pilot doesn't respond to the order to land, shoot it down.
The stealth bomber cruised serenely at 44,000 feet as Matthews and Brotskarnov monitored the radios for converging air traffic. Matthews, to avoid a possible mid-air collision, continued to fly between cardinal flight levels. The morning light was rapidly overtaking the B-2 as it passed a point 1,180 miles northeast of Honolulu. Shadow 37 would be visible to aerial observers in 45 minutes. Matthews heard a Northwest Airlines pilot call another Northwest flight.
At Northwest 67, Northwest 329. We just had a call from operations. Seems the word is being passed to look out for the B-2, the stealth bomber that disappeared.
Matthews sensed Brotskarnov glance at him.
Okay, the astonished co-pilot radioed. Any idea of the general location?
Negative, the 747 captain answered.
The military has a full-scale search underway. They believe the B-2 is airborne somewhere between the North Atlantic and the Western Pacific, and the commercial crews are being asked to be on alert.
Ah, 6-7, the co-pilot said, then paused and keyed his radio again. Any news on Cuba?
All we know is that Jarrett kicked him in the dirt this morning.
Matthews, concealing his emotions, began to hope. If he could only enhance the possibility of being intercepted. He needed to induce an engine failure in order to descend to an altitude where most of the traffic flew. The first rays of sunlight began to illuminate the cockpit as Matthews prepared to execute his daring plan. He waited until Brotskarnov was occupied scanning the horizon, then eased his left hand down to the circuit breaker panel next to his seat. Matthews felt along the rows of buttons, pinched the number 3 engine oil pressure breaker, and popped it out. He moved his hand back to his thigh as the engine instrument and crew alerting system annunciator lights flashed on, lighting the dim cockpit with a reddish-amber glow. The synoptic display projected a diagram of number 3 engine oil system, indicating a failure. "God damn it," Matthews exclaimed as convincingly as possible. "We've lost oil pressure on number 3. General, watch our rate of descent while I go through the shutdown checklist." Simmons, leaning forward in his straps, was tense and jumpy. "I think," Matthews said, "that we can maintain 40,000 feet. Brutskarnov answered with a strained voice, "Whatever you have to do." The stealth bomber descended slowly toward 40,000 feet as sunlight filled the cockpit. The new jumbo jet on Flight 12, flying eastbound at 41,000 feet, left 4 distinct white contrails in the morning sky. Both pilots, relaxed and monitoring their navigation plot, were unprepared for what they were about to witness. Chuck Matthews looked out to the horizon, studying the cloud cover in front of the bomber. He could tell that a major winter storm was developing over the northern Pacific. Matthews was caught unprepared when he saw contrails approaching the B-2 from 11 o'clock high. The white trails, closing rapidly, appeared to be 5 to 6 miles away. Matthews shot a glance at Brutskarnov, who seemed to be deep in thought. Simmons had his head lowered and was staring at the flight deck. The B-2 pilot, knowing that the bomber did not generate contrails, had to do something to make the aircraft visible. He manipulated the fuel controls, raised his hand an inch, then activated the fuel dump switch. The caution light illuminated, but no one noticed. Hundreds of pounds of fuel streamed out of the bomber in 2 frothy white trails. The first officer on Cathay Pacific Flight 12 handed his breakfast tray to the smiling flight attendant, then turned in his seat. He was peering out of the windshield as the B-2 commenced dumping fuel. The 2 white trails showcased the stealth bomber directly in front of the 747. "Look," the co-pilot pointed. It's a B-2. The captain focused outside. "Good God, you're right. Think we should notify someone?" The pilot nodded his head. "Yeah, I think so. Kind of strange dumping fuel over the middle of the pond and being at the wrong altitude." Matthews discreetly deselected fuel dump and turned the VH radio to 121.5 and the UHF sets to 243.0, the international distress frequencies. He knew that if anyone attempted to contact Shadow 37, they would most likely try the guard emergency frequency. "We have a sighting," the airborne controller said over the intercom, then keyed his radio and talked to the Air Guard F-15 flight leader. "Rainbow Leader, we have a confirmation on the B-2. Your 352 angles 390 to 400 to 210 miles. Heading approximately 340. The radar operator waited a moment, receiving further information through his headset. "You are cleared to intercept. Repeat, you are cleared to intercept." "Mr. President," Kirchner said, "the B-2 has been spotted over the northern Pacific, north of the Hawaiian Islands." "Well, who spotted it?" "An airliner, a Cathay Pacific flight," Kirchner answered. "We're vectoring Air Force fighters for an intercept." "Well, excellent. Let's get everyone in the situation room as soon as possible." "Rainbow Leader," the controller radioed, staring at his radar console. "Continue present course. We believe you should be overtaking the B-2 soon." Roger, the F-15 pilot eased a stick to the left and glanced out at the horizon. He froze when he saw the stealth bomber whisk through the layer of stringy dark clouds. "Son of a bitch," the fighter pilot said in his oxygen mask, then keyed his radio. "Pelican, Rainbow Lead has a tally on the B-2. "Roger, Roger," the excited AWACS officer replied. "Wilco," the controller radioed, "Rainbow Lead, close on the B-2 and contact on guard." "Roger," the startled pilot said. "Confirm the call sign." "Shadow 3-7. "Copy." Matthews snapped his head to the left and stared at the cockpit of an F-15 Eagle. Matthews saw the Hawaiian Air National Guard lettering on the aircraft at the same instant the fighter pilot transmitted over the radio. "Shadow 3-7, Shadow 3-7, Rainbow Leader on guard. Do you copy?" Simmons bolted upright as Brutskarnov leaned over the console and stared at the American fighter in wide-eyed astonishment. We'd better talk to him, Matthews cautioned, turning to Simmons. The game is over. Shadow 3-7, Rainbow lead on guard. The F-15 pilot radioed, easing closer to the nose of the B-2. We have orders to shoot you down if you do not comply. Do you copy? Matthews shot a glance at the Eagle pilot and turned to Bruskarnov. They've got us, goddammit. The Russian officer blanched, snapped off the autopilot, grabbed his set of controls, and shoved the three throttles forward. The hell they do, the Russian pilot barked, yanking the bomber into a tight, climbing turn to the right. Matthews reached for his controls at the same instant that Simmons pressed the revolver against the pilot's ribs. The stunned fighter pilot, unprepared for the B-2's abrupt maneuver, tried to close on the bomber. When the two aircraft entered the dense clouds, the F-15 pilot, concerned about a mid-air collision, pulled his throttles back and shoved the nose over. Pelican, Rainbow lead, I've lost the target. He pulled into the clouds. Stand by, the controller radioed. Are you in a position to try another intercept? Negative, I'm not painting anything on the scope. They just disappeared into the soup. Get the nose down, Matthews ordered, watching the airspeed decrease rapidly. We're going to stall. Bruskarnov shoved the nose down and turned back to the original heading. The Russian pilot's hands were shaking as he leveled the bomber at 42,300 feet. Shadow 37, bouncing lightly in the dense clouds, accelerated to cruise speed again. They're going to shoot us down, Matthews said, feeling the revolver in his side. It's only a matter of time. Simmons shoved harder on the barrel of the gun. Shut up, Colonel. Matthews, ignoring the technician, leaned closer to Bruskarnov. There's no way out. They've got us surrounded. The wily Russian slowly turned his head. Engage the autopilot. We will be okay if we can remain in the clouds. The airborne command and control officer called Shadow 37 on guard a dozen times, then radioed the E-2C Hawkeye controlling the Navy aircraft from Carl Vinson. The Hawkeye radar controller vectored two sections of F-14s toward a rendezvous with the bomber. Sundowners, come port 15 degrees and climb to 450. We've got a B-2 coming down the pike. We're projecting that she'll overfly the B-2 in 21 minutes. The Tomcat pilot looked over his glare shield. We got a thick cloud of cover out here. Copy, the Hawkeye officer replied. Don't show a thing, not a trace of the B-2. We're just extrapolating at this point. Chuck Matthews had resigned himself to the only choice he had left. He needed to create a major distraction in order for his desperate plan to work. General Bruskarnov, staring intently through the curved windshield, saw flecks of blue sky overhead. We must descend to stay in the clouds. Matthews, contemplating the odds of his survival, wordlessly programmed the flight director to descend back to 40,000 feet. The F-14 passed over Shadow 37, a half mile off the bomber's left wing. The B-2 was visible as it descended through the wisps of clouds. Okay, the pilot said to himself as he called the Hawkeye and started a left 180-degree turn. Sundowner 1 has a tally on the B-2. 2, come port with me and let's start a descent. Sundowner lead, the Hawkeye controller said. Make visual contact with the crew and attempt comm on guard. Call sign Shadow 3-7. Have the aircraft turn toward Hawaii. Roger, the Tomcat pilot radioed. The lead F-14 radioed the bomber on 243.0. Shadow 3-7, Sundowner lead on guard. Come port 150. Acknowledge. Matthews, startled by the unexpected radio call, looked out of his side window as the Tomcat slid into view. The pilot raised his visor and waved. Bruskarnov swore loudly and grabbed the flight control, shoving the nose down. Jesus Christ, Matthews said, feeling the negative G-load as loose objects floated up in the cockpit. Simmons, almost dropping his revolver, gripped his seat tightly. Shadow 3-7, the F-14 pilot said as he countered the violent maneuver. We have been ordered to shoot you down. Do you copy? Matthews decided to make his move. Now let me have the controls. Bruskarnov appeared suspicious, then released the stick. I know the aircraft better, Matthews shouted, clutching the control stick. I can evade them. The B-2 was between cloud layers when Matthews snapped the bomber into a tight left turn. Check out the right, Matthews ordered. See anyone? Bruskarnov and Simmons leaned closer to the right side window, gazing out over the wing. Matthews, seizing the opportunity, reached up and pulled his red-flagged ejection seat pin. The rocket-powered seat was now armed to fire. Matthews quickly stuffed the bright cloth and metal pin under his left thigh as Bruskarnov turned to him. I do not see fighters. Keep checking, Matthews replied.
Shadow 3-7, the F-14 pilot radioed in a strained voice. I'm going to fire a missile in 30 seconds. Turn to 150, your last warning.
The Tomcat dropped back 200 yards as the pilot selected master arm on and heard the lock-on tone.
10 seconds,
the pilot radioed, watching the bomber turn again.
5 seconds.
Matthews quickly moved his hand toward the alternate ejection handle when the F-14 pilot fired a sidewinder at Shadow 37.
Fox 2!
Matthews jinked the bomber up. Brutskarnoff and Simmons braced themselves as the B-2 plunged into the cloud bank. The missile, fired too close to track properly, flashed under the bomber's left wing. The Hawkeye controller watched the sidewinder continue toward the horizon, then noticed something alarming.
The MiGs fired! The radio controller shouted over guard. They detected you shot 2 missiles. The MiGs have 2 missiles away.
Sundowners, the flight leader ordered.
Unload. Let's go for the deck. Take it down.
Oh, Jesus, a voice shouted as Matthews grasped his ejection handle.
Lead is on fire. Lead is hit. All aircraft, the controller shouted. Go weapons hold. Weapons hold.
Matthews gripped the handle firmly, focusing on the next 3 seconds. His mind raced as he fought to hold the nose in level flight. Adrenaline pumping, Matthews paused a fraction of a second, then yanked on the ejection handle. The explosive blast hurled the American pilot more than 150 feet above the B-2. Matthews tumbled through the sky, separated from a seat, then went into a free fall to a lower altitude where his parachute would automatically open. The stealth, trimmed full nose up, pitched violently upward into the clouds. Brutskarnoff, blinded and burned by the rocket blast, slumped semi-conscious in his seat. The Russian pilot groaned as Simmons unstrapped, then staggered to grab Matthews' control stick. Simmons grasped the stick with his burned hands. He could barely see as he forced the B-2's nose toward level flight. Unaware that the trim was full nose up, the technician kept pressure on the stick. His mind, desperate in his pain and panic, searched for a way to remain alive. Simmons forced the bomber around, forcing the nose down. Feeling the howling wind increase, Simmons pulled the 3 throttles back to idle and raised the nose. Brutskarnoff, now unconscious, was hanging over the left side of his ejection seat. Simmons, on his knees in the cavity left of the pilot's seat, felt the bomber tremble at the verge of a stall. The B-2, pointed skyward, was losing speed rapidly. As the airspeed decayed, the nose dropped dangerously low. Simmons, recognizing that the stealth was becoming unmaneuverable, shoved the throttles forward and pulled savagely on the control stick. Shadow 37 stalled, rolled off on the right wing, then spun out of control toward the cold, windswept sea. The bomber, spinning, inverted, fell 7 miles through the dark clouds as Simmons tried to recover control of the aircraft. He cried out in anguish as the image of Irina Rykov flashed through his mind. Shadow 37 slammed into the water and exploded into a thunderous fireball. Lieutenant Colonel Charles Matthews was the only witness to the crash of Shadow 37. He was hanging from his parachute when the stealth bomber exploded 3 miles away. The flash and low, rolling rumble startled the B-2 pilot as he prepared his life raft for entry into the storm-tossed ocean. Matthews plunged into the ice-cold water, gasping for air as his windswept parachute dragged him over 200 yards through the towering waves. He swallowed 2 gulps of seawater before he could release the parachute risers. Freeing himself from the parachute canopy, he struggled into the one-man raft, shivering uncontrollably until he was able to zip the raft's rubber and nylon cover closed around his neck. 3 hours after Shadow 37 had actually crashed, with the weather worsening and darkness approaching, the search was canceled. By that time, if it had not crashed, the commanders agreed it would have already landed on Russian soil. Chuck Matthews, after spending a chilly night in his life raft, heard a jet early the next morning. He fired 4 flares, then shouted with joy as the jet turned toward him. Matthews was surprised when the Sukhoi Su-27 pilot circled the raft twice and rocked his wings. The Russian fighter pilot radioed the coordinates to the communication room and then returned to the carrier. 50 minutes later, Matthews was hoisted aboard a Soviet helicopter and flown to the USS Carl Vinson. After Matthews had undergone a quick debrief, The White House was immediately notified of the fate of Shadow 37 and Major Paul Evans. Matthews remained on board the carrier for 24 hours before being transported to Elmendorf Air Force Base. He was flown to Washington, D.C., and was thoroughly debriefed at the White House and the Pentagon. After a 30-day leave, Matthews returned to Whiteman Air Force Base, where he was promoted to squadron commanding officer. Aerial photographs of San Julian after the air attack indicated that the stealth hangar had been gutted by fire. The Joint Chiefs assessed the damage and concluded that the tapes that Matthews had mentioned must have been destroyed. The stealth was gone, but the secrets of its technology remained documented only in the United States. Relations with Cuba remained extremely volatile. In weekly broadcasts, Castro continually threatened to sink American aircraft carriers if the United States should provoke him again. The threat was not taken too seriously, though. President Jarrett kept two carrier groups in the Gulf of Mexico. Fidel Castro stubbornly refused to agree to any restitution agreement. He renewed his pledge to perfect a single Leninist party in the Western Hemisphere based on the principles of centralism. The last chapter in his reign of terror was only pages away.